it's cool to me to, and I hold on to so much stuff from my wrestling that I have the card from when I wrestled Undertaker. I have posters. I have all the posters we've been on. I have all my figures. And I have them not for me, but someday I maybe want to hand them to my son and say, hey, here. And if he wants it or not, but I've been given the opportunity to give that to him. And he's one of the biggest fans in the world. So for him to be able to see what I've done and the person that it's made me, I can't really describe it. It's I guess if I had a goal in life, it was to be as good a dad as my dad. And I think I'm on my way. And I guess for me to be able to do that, it's super special.
Life is not guaranteed. Nothing in life is. But I mean, life itself. You know, you take it for granted, you go to bed at night, you close your eyes, you expect to wake up the next day. That's how it's supposed to be. If you're a wrestling fan, you are almost desensitized at this point to hearing about death. Hear about it far too often. And there's been so many of them over the years. There's been so many this year alone. This week alone. I was ready to come on here and say a few words about Danny Hodge and Kevin Green. You know, people die every year. But 2020 just feels more cruel than most. And even with all of that awfulness, I was stunned when I heard that Brody Lee had passed away at 41 years old. I'm still stunned. It doesn't compute. That's not supposed to happen. That doesn't feel real. He just celebrated his birthday a week and a half ago. I didn't even know he was sick. Very few people did. Sounds like only his family and maybe a small inner circle of people knew what was going on. You know, I, like a lot of you, thought he was out with an injury. I was asking some of those same questions over the weeks. Hey, where's Brody Lee? And, you know, it never really occurred to me that if he was out with a minor injury, he could still be on TV. Or he could be filming comedy sketches for Being the Elite. Could be doing stuff with the Dark Order. Or he would be tweeting. You know, he hadn't tweeted since October 7th. That was the night that he lost the TNT title in that dog collar match on TV to Cody. Never occurred to me that he could be sick. And why would it? I mean, why would anybody think that? The man was 41 years old. And he was in the middle of what I'm sure he looked at as this big prime run of his career. Doing what made him happy and hopeful for, you know, bigger and better things in 2021. I mean, he wasn't the youngest guy in the wrestling business anymore, but there was no reason to believe that anything like this could ever happen. Look at him in the dog collar match the last time we saw him. He looked fine outside of all the blood when the match was over. Never in a million years would I have expected that would be his final match. And what a last match it was. It was violent, it was bloody, and it is one hell of a final match. His wife, Amanda, posted this on Instagram. She said, "My best friend died today. I never wanted to write those words. My heart is broken. The world saw him as the amazing Brody Lee, formerly known as Luke Harper, but he was my best friend, my husband, and the greatest father you could ever meet. No words can express the love I feel or how broken I am right now. He passed surrounded by loved ones after a hard-fought battle with a non-COVID-related lung issue. The Mayo Clinic is literally the best team of doctors and nurses in the world who surrounded me with constant love. On top of that, I cannot express my love and admiration for the way that AEW has treated not only my husband, but myself and my kids. I've been surrounded by so much love and incredible people, I can't tag them all, but they know who they are, and I don't think they will ever know how thankful I am for them. Mike Johnson reports that he was hospitalized at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville for some time, for many, many weeks, with the entire, and again, I don't know that the entire locker room knew what was going on, but certainly members of the AEW roster and brain trust that did know were basically staying silent. They upheld this oath to say nothing publicly, to give no indication of what was going on, to not talk about him at all, to give the family the privacy that they needed or that maybe they wanted. And that is all we know so far. I'm not going to speculate beyond that. That is all that we know. 41 years old. I'm not much younger than he was. And it just makes you stop and think how quickly things can turn on a dime. You had two little boys that by every account, every message, every story, every tweet, every Instagram post, every video that I saw of him, he absolutely adored. Brody and Nolan. Go watch any interview or go listen to any podcast that he appeared on. He always talks about his kids. They were the center of his universe. They were his world. He told a story on the AEW Unrestricted podcast last month. He was just on there last month. I don't know when that was filmed, but it was after, I believe, he lost the TNT title. So it's a recent interview. He was on their podcast last month talking about winning the TNT title. And when he did, sneaking the title belt when he got home into his son's bed. I guess his son was sleeping. And he snuck the title into his bed so that when he woke up the next morning, he would wake up and he would find the championship. And then he could see his reaction. It's very unfair. It's very unfair that his sons now have to grow up without their dad. And they're going to hear all these wonderful stories, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people looking after them and looking after that family, but it's not the same. It's not the same. And that is the real tragedy in all this. I mean, we could talk about wrestling and his matches and his career, and I will, but that is inconsequential when it comes to the impact that this is going to have on his family. All of this other stuff is just trivial by comparison. On the most recent episode of Dark, and this is just amazing stuff. Obviously, there were people who knew what was going on. They knew how serious it was. They were doing everything they could to try to accommodate the family. And on the most recent episode of Dark, the Dark Order, the faction that he led, had a six-man tag team match. And at one point during the match, the action spills outside. And one of the Dark Order members walks over to this young boy in the front row who has a mask on, a Dark Order mask, a creeper mask. And it wasn't a high five, but he sort of locked hands with him. It's kind of like a high five gesture. And the kid's got a chain around his neck. He's got a kendo stick in his hand. And the announcers refer to him as Negative One. The newest member of the Dark Order, Negative One. And that was Brody's son. That was Brody's son, Brody Jr., under a mask. There was also a segment at the end of the tapings that had Kenny Omega losing the AEW world title to Brody. You know, Brody pinned him, and they had Justin Roberts announce him as the new AEW world champion. I don't know if they filmed it just to show
Huber, you know, in Brody Lee, in the hospital, or if they did it just to give his son a special moment. That's a very cool thing for them to do. Obviously, they knew how dire the situation was, and that was a very nice gesture on their part. But not only did he love his kids like crazy, he was a great dad. He was a huge animal lover. He had dogs, he had cats, he had chickens. And one of the many cool stories that I saw, and there were many, there were so many. I mean, to say that he was trending last night would be an understatement. Everybody would, my whole timeline was nothing but Brody Lee, which is pretty cool. And it goes to show you the impression that he made on so many different people in AEW, out of AEW, WWE, everywhere. Everywhere. But one of the many cool stories that I read was from a road producer for WWE who worked with him quite a bit, Dustin Wallace. And he said, I had the fortunate opportunity to document several day-in-the-life pieces with Harper. I met his son, his wife, and his chickens through these shoots. His sense of humor is something everyone knew. When he debuted with the Wyatt family in 2013, Harper had one request. He said, I want to do a video with dogs. And for over a year, he would jokingly come up to me and ask if the dogs were here to film with him. And they never were. And finally, one day, I was so happy to be able to finally answer, yes, we've got dogs. When I told him that we had a dog shoot, he said that he was too busy. He had other things to do, and that he was too busy. And he saw the defeat in my face and started laughing uncontrollably, and said that he was just joking, and he raced over to meet the dogs. And he says he never forgot that, and I will never forget him. I lost track of all the messages from people all around the wrestling business. WWE issued a statement. Pretty much every major promotion did. Obviously, AEW, Impact, all put out official statements. Tons of WWE stars that he worked with, people he was friendly with, have shared memories and left messages and stories. But Bray Wyatt's, and that was the one I was really waiting on. Because, obviously, they worked very closely with one another, became very good friends. And he posted something on Instagram that was the most, I mean, outside of what his wife wrote, the most heartbreaking thing of all. Because you can feel it. Just reading the words on a screen, you could feel the pain in his voice. Said, you were my best friend, my brother, my partner, my Terry Gordy. We changed this whole game because we refused to do it any way but our way. We were always at our best when we were a team. I think we both knew it. We fought like brothers because we were. I'm so goddamn pissed. This isn't how it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be us, fat, bald, and useless, running Wyatt family spots in high school gyms in our 70s. Where do we go now? What do I do knowing I'll never hear your condescending sarcasm as I am riding high? I miss you so fucking much already. I would do anything just to live through our worst moments again. Can't believe you're gone. I'm so sorry, brother. You will always be a part of me, whether I like it or not. Without you, everything is different. And I hope Amanda truly knows that I'm here, not just saying it because I love them too. I will make sure your son knows the incredible man you were. Not the legends people will tell, but the real you that very few people got to see. I promise I'll put him over clean in dark matches when he's old enough, just like I promised. I'm hurting so bad. I wish I had the chance to say goodbye. But then again, it is Saturday, and you know what that means. Save me a seat next to you wherever you are. That's where I belong. I'll be there when it's my time. Goodbye forever, Brody. I love you. The Wyatt family, the Wyatt family was his big break. and one of my favorite WWE matches of the last decade, and really one of the best six-man tag team matches I've ever seen in the history of that company, is that first meeting at the Elimination Chamber in 2014 between the Wyatt family and the Shield. The crowd was chanting, "This is awesome," before they even touched. Before they even touched. They had a standoff and the crowd was on their feet chanting, "This is awesome." And the next 20 plus minutes is everything I love about pro wrestling. From the build-up to the beginning of the match, right down to the finish. An outstanding match. And their follow-up match that they had, I think it was on Raw a few weeks later, also an excellent match. But the magic of that Elimination Chamber match, that very first meeting in front of that crowd on that night, is something special that you just can't replicate. You just can't. Another match from that year that does not get as much attention, but I was thinking back, you know, to his best matches in WWE, and I thought of the Battleground match, which I sometimes forget about. But the Battleground match that he and Eric Rowan had against the Usos that same year. It was 2 out of 3 falls for the tag team titles. That was an excellent match. Later that year, he had the chance to be more than just a sidekick to Bray Wyatt, and he won the Intercontinental title. So he could be more than just a tag team guy. Now, he only had the title for, I think it was 20-something days. It was less than a month. He didn't hold it for very long before he dropped it to Dolph Ziggler in that brutal TLC match. And that was another excellent match that he was part of that year. So really, if you look at 2014 in particular for Luke Harper, it's a pretty damn good year. When you look at the body of work as a member of the Wyatt family that he was able to be part of or that he was able to put together, 2014 may have been his best year in that company. And not because he got worse or because with age he slowed down, but it just seemed like that was the year where he really had a chance to go out there and just open a lot of eyes and show what he could do, you know, for a bigger guy. He was a big guy. He wasn't 7 feet tall, but he was a bigger guy by comparison to a lot of other people on that roster. And very agile for a big guy. He was able to do things that, you know, a lot of guys his size, especially many years ago, either wouldn't try to do or couldn't do. And I'm not sure we ever truly really got to see what he was fully capable of in that company. But what we got to see from him, especially that year, was some great stuff that absolutely, if you're looking to go back and spend a few minutes watching old Luke Harper matches, that's the year I would target. And I would go back and check out some of those bouts. But that ladder match with Dolph was insane. Those guys went out there and they just destroyed each other. You know, he almost broke his arm in that match. He was bleeding from the arm. Dolph was bleeding. Those guys stole the show at TLC that night. He looked like a man who was on a mission. He looked like he was a man with something to prove. And, you know, even in defeat, even dropping the title that night, he was hopeful that that could be the start of something for him heading into the new year. And it was frustrating, you know, years later after he had left the company and he did a whole bunch of interviews. He was on Talk is Jericho and, you know, hearing him tell these stories and talk about the frustrations that he had coming out of that ladder match with Dolph, because it just all fell apart because he was told, "Well, we don't have anything for you. Or we're just going to, you know, have you keep doing Wyatt family stuff." All he wanted to do was break out on his own and forge his own path. All he wanted was a chance. You know, the angle where Randy Orton had infiltrated the Wyatt family, which was probably end of 2016, going into the beginning of 2017. Harper was the one who didn't trust Orton. He was very distrustful of Randy Orton, the way he would glance over at him. He was the guy who would, you know, you could picture telling Bray, look, I don't trust this guy. It was actually a great story that they crafted. And Harper, he told this story as well. He said he told the writers, flat out, told the writers, look, the way that you're crafting this story, I'm going to be the one who gets over. And they said, no. We have it written a certain way. He said, okay, but I'm telling you, I'm the one. I'm going to start getting big reactions, and I'm going to be the one who starts getting over here, even though it really was not designed for that purpose. He was not the one they were trying to get over. They were trying to get over Randy and Bray and that whole story, and he was just supposed to be sort of a bit player that helped facilitate that, but he was smart enough to look at it and go, you know what? I see the writing on the wall here. I'm just telling you guys. And of course, he was right, and they were wrong. And the crowds really started to become more invested in Luke Harper, even though that was not designed to be what, you know, the outcome of that was. But that really was the point, right? They didn't want him to get over. He wasn't the focus. He wasn't the focal point. It was the other two. I maintain to this day that it would have turned out much better. That WrestleMania match in Orlando should have been a triple threat match. And I'm normally not a fan of doing the multi-man stuff for the title at WrestleMania. If ever there was a time, that story was so good that that should have been the end result. And it's a shame he never got that moment. But he got out of there eventually, and he landed in AEW. And he was all set to debut earlier this year as the Exalted One, the leader of the Dark Order. And it was going to be in his hometown. He was a New York boy. He was from Rochester, New York, and that's where Dynamite, I think March 18th, was scheduled to be. And what a homecoming it would have been for him. He would have gotten a hero's welcome. The hometown boy returns home. And then COVID changed all of that. In fact, I think that was the very first pandemic show where there were no fans in attendance. But for the first time, he really had a chance to be a leader and not a follower. And he even admitted, he said, you know, it's exciting, but it's scary. Because for years, I talked about how I want the opportunity. I just give me the chance. Just give me the ball. And he felt it wasn't given to him. They didn't believe in him. And you could always lean on that as an excuse. Well, the reason it didn't work out for me is because they didn't give me the chance, right? Oh, it's their fault, not my fault. And he said, well, now in AEW, you have the creative freedom to, you know, or at least more than he had previously. He goes, I can't make any excuses anymore. He goes, this is either going to work or it's not. I'm going to succeed or I'm going to fail. And I can't blame the promoter. I can't blame the company. I have nobody to blame but myself. But he was grateful to finally have, you know, at 40 years old, the chance to go out there and just show what it is that he can really do. But I thought he had a damn good brawl with Jon Moxley at Double or Nothing back in May for the AEW title. He was thrust into that match. Probably would not have happened that quickly were it not for COVID. I believe that was probably one of the changes made to the card. It felt like it was coming a little too quickly. Didn't feel like he really had much of a shot, so I wouldn't say there was a lot of drama. But those two went out there and they beat the hell out of each other, and they had what I thought was a very worthy, very physical world title match on that pay-per-view. And one of the most memorable matches of the pandemic era was the night that he squashed Cody to win the TNT title in about 3 minutes. It was just such a dominant, lopsided beating, and I think I even said at the time, the only thing I could really compare it to, although, you know, on a smaller level, it wasn't a pay-per-view main event or anything, but SummerSlam back in 2014, when Brock Lesnar thoroughly embarrassed and destroyed John Cena in a way that caught a lot of people by surprise. This caught a lot of people by surprise, too, and it was, you know, I think a lot of people looked at that and said, okay, this is Brody Lee. This guy went in there. He was like an animal. Went in there. He tore this guy limb from limb. beat him fair and square in the middle for the championship. The whole ending to that episode of Dynamite, everything that followed the match, laying out all the members of the Rhodes family, standing dominant over them, him and the Dark Order, that was the best the Dark Order ever looked, and that is still, to this day, one of the best finishes to an episode of Dynamite that they've ever done. That was one of the best things they did all year. It really, I think in a lot of ways, was the highlight of his AEW run. And, you know, people also forget, as far as his run, it wasn't very long as TNT champion. It wasn't that long. But it was fairly successful. He had a couple of TV matches on Dynamite that did very well in the ratings, even to my surprise. I think there was a match he had a title defense against Orange Cassidy. But there was a match with Dustin Rhodes that on paper, it didn't necessarily feel like or sound like a main event. But it was positioned as the main event, and that was, you know, a big title match on TV, and I believe it was the Dustin match that did over 1 million viewers, which was pretty surprising. But I would imagine for him, when he probably found that out, probably put a big smile on his face. You know, his last match was the dog collar match with Cody back in October. They even brought in Greg Valentine, right, a veteran of maybe the most classic dog collar match in wrestling history, to be in the building that night to watch the match. And he and Cody went out there and they both bled and they both used, you know, the chain, and they definitely took advantage of the stipulation. That was a very violent affair. Can't say that it didn't live up to the stipulation. But what his future may have held, we'll never know. You know, his AEW contract gave him the freedom to work dates for New Japan if he wanted to. And to listen to him speak, he very much wanted to work for New Japan. The only thing that was stopping him was the pandemic and the fact that there was no travel at that time between the two countries. It was going to be very difficult to make that happen. He probably would have ended up there at some point in the next year. At the end of the day, he seemed like a good, decent man who loved his family and made everybody that he worked with laugh. Not a bad word said. Everybody sharing stories and photos. I mean, you could tell how much they loved this guy. They loved his company. They loved working with him. They loved sharing a locker room with him. They loved being around him. If there was some kind of tragedy or some kind of health issue or some kind of anything negative going on in their lives or with their careers, or they got released or whatever the case may be, he was on the phone to them, sometimes for hours at a time. He was that person. You could probably count those people on one hand that you have in your life, and he was one of those people. I'm happy that he got the chance to break out on his own and have the success that he had. He deserved more time on this earth to watch his sons grow up and to watch Brody Jr. follow in his footsteps. He's already doing wrestling tournaments. I'm sure he'll probably end up in the wrestling business following his father's path. And if they grow up to be the kind of man that he was, from the sounds of it and all of the stories and all the accounts from the people who knew him, then the world will be a better place. Tomorrow isn't promised, so make the most of today. Rest in peace, John Huber. This is episode 684 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, December 27th, 2020. I hope everybody celebrating had a Merry Christmas. And I want to take a moment here to thank each and every person who has supported this show throughout the entire year in any way. But especially, you know, the people whose names you hear me read off every single week. It's the least I can do to acknowledge them and just show my appreciation and recognize them here as part of the show. And they love being part of the show and being part of this community. And here's to an even bigger and better 2021. I'm splitting this final roll call for this week into two parts. So if you don't hear your name now, You will later. I want to say thank you to the Sound Off Group Messiah, Jeff Lippman. Thank you to him. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Naef Al-Safar, the Guardian Angel, Jacob Donnelly. Thank you for the major love this week, Jacob. Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Passera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Raymond the Mountie Medina, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, I hope you and the entire family, Money Maxwell and Grand Slam Grayson all had a very Merry Christmas. And my thanks to Jay Coggs for the 5 stars and the review on iTunes. He says he loves the retrospectives like This Week in History, and his favorite is RSPW Rewind. And there'll be more of that. There'll be more of both going into the new year. In fact, I was just doing some research the other day, and I came across a whole new cache of posts to dig into for some future installments of RSPW on the YouTube channel. So that's something to look forward to in the new year. Again, thank you to everybody. We'll have more shouts coming up here in a little bit. There is a lot to get into this week. Obviously, I had to kind of blow things up a little bit here at the beginning because there was no, and there is no bigger story than, you know, the death of John Huber. And that's something that's going to reverberate. You're going to be seeing tributes and hearing a lot about him on TV this week, I'm sure, on both channels, as well we should. And so that is going to be the dominant story, but there is a lot of other stuff that happened. There is a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about here. One thing that I do want to mention for those who might be able to join, there are going to be not one, but 2 more podcasts this year. This is not the final Sound Off, technically. This might be the final Sound Off episode for the year, but there will be a live AEW Dynamite stream on Wednesday night. I'm sure that's going to be an emotional episode. That's the first night of their New Year's Smash, night 1 of 2. We did NXT this week. It's going to be back to AEW on Wednesday night. The very next night, I'm going to be live on YouTube, same time, 10 p.m. Eastern, for a special New Year's Eve stream. So if you don't have any plans, and I know some people who might ordinarily have plans are probably not going out this year, there might not be as much going on, come on and join on YouTube. Because we're doing what I'm calling the official Sound Off to Hell with 2020 stream as we ring in the new year. So come join me. Come join me as we flip off 2020 and flip over to 2021. Special Sound Off Inbox Edition, very similar to what we did for the anniversary last month. I'm going to be going through a bunch of email questions this week, pulling questions from my inbox, thesolemonster@gmail.com. We'll take super chats, maybe even some phone calls. I don't know. We'll have a good time. We'll try to ring in the new year in a positive light and put this year behind us. So again, that's coming up on Thursday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. To hell with 2020. I hope you can all join me. Unfortunately, the old adage about deaths or celebrity deaths, that they come in threes, right? We've all heard that. Oh, they come in threes. Well, that came true this week. If you're a wrestling fan, that came true this week. Brody Lee was not the only wrestling-related death in this beyond awful year. Probably the greatest, certainly one of the greatest amateur wrestlers that ever lived, Danny Hodge, passed away on Christmas Day at the age of 88. He had been suffering from dementia in recent years. He went missing briefly back in 2018, and his family was worried that he wouldn't be able to find his way home. They didn't know where he went. They called the police. The police issued an alert, and he was found safe about 90 miles away from home. And I think that's when people first realized how sick he was. I don't know how sick he may have been before that, but I don't know that it was public knowledge that he was suffering from dementia at that time. That certainly raised some eyebrows, though, and indicated that something was wrong. He was a hero to a lot of people like Jim Ross and Gerald Briscoe. They talked about him like he was a god, like he was a god among men. And that's got to be tough for Briscoe. Losing Pat Patterson and Danny Hodge, one right after the other like that, two very good friends of his. He's in pretty much every wrestling Hall of Fame that you can imagine, except the WWE Hall of Fame. I don't believe he's in that one. But in all the other Hall of Fames that matter and all that, he's pretty much inducted in every single one of them. And he is only one of two wrestlers ever to grace the cover of Sports Illustrated. Hulk Hogan was the other. And Danny Hodge did it as an amateur. But that is some very, very small company to be part of. He went 46-0 at the University of Oklahoma, never even got taken off his feet, let alone beaten. Not one time. Silver medalist in the 1956 Olympic Games. He was on his way to a gold medal when he got tied up with his opponent, like in a pretzel, and his shoulders just barely touched the mat. And one of the judges called it a loss. So he had to settle for the silver that year. He had double tendons. This is another thing you're going to read if you do some research on Danny Hodge. He talked about having double tendons. I don't know if it is his wrist or his hands. So he was known, I mean, for his grip and the strength of his grip. He was well known for that. Well known. He was well known for being able to crush apples, squeeze them until they exploded with his bare hands, even into his 80s. He was still doing that into his 70s and his 80s. I mean, I've also read he could break a pair of pliers. If you gave him a pair of pliers, like from the hardware store. I've never actually seen video of him doing that, so I can't vouch for that. But I've seen video of him crushing apples in his hand, and people are always amazed by that. But put it this way. You did not want to shake hands with Danny Hodge if he did not like you. You definitely did not want to do that. But his pro wrestling career, he was also, you know, a very decorated pro wrestler. He was a champion in the NWA. His pro wrestling career ended very abruptly in 1976. And his life almost ended as well. It's a horrible car accident. Greg Oliver over at slamwrestling.net tells the story. Hodge fell asleep at the wheel one night and he crashed into a bridge. His car, maybe he was on the bridge and he crashed into the side of it. I'm not sure, but he fell asleep at the wheel. He crashed and his car flipped. And all of a sudden, as he awoke, he found that the car was underwater at the bottom of a creek down below, very cold creek. And he had a broken neck. Now it's in the middle of the night. I mean, think about this. He has crashed. He's severely injured, probably disoriented, at the bottom of a creek, in the middle of the night with nobody around, in freezing cold water. Most people, that is where their life would have come to an end. He claims he heard a voice of God, I guess, telling him, hold your neck, hold your neck. And so that's what he did. Put his hand on his neck, he held his neck in place, he climbed out of the car through a broken window, swam, I guess through, was I think, 9 feet of water, back up onto the road where a truck driver eventually drove by and spotted him, radioed for help. He was transported to the hospital. They took bone from his hip. They fused that with his neck. And at that point, he never wrestled again. Never did pro wrestling again. Not one person who knew him or worked with him speaks about him with anything but reverence. Again, it's almost as if he was just looked at by all of these people as this god, this wrestling god. You know, JBL used to call himself, I'm a wrestling god. Well, Danny Hodge was a wrestling god. And so that was very sad to hear of his passing this week. NFL Hall of Famer Kevin Green also passed away this week. He was quite a bit younger, 58 years old. He was a big wrestling fan, and he worked a series of matches in WCW during that Monday Night War period while He was still an active player in the NFL. So I don't know how happy the teams were with him doing that, but still an active player, an elite player, but also wrestling some matches for WCW. That first match that he had was a tag team match. It was him and Mongo McMichael, another NFL player, taking on Ric Flair and Arn Anderson. That match was better than it had any right. I mean, I haven't seen that match in forever, but it was better than it had any right to be. When you consider their level of experience, he and Mongo in the ring at that time. And I mean, there's a Twitter account that, you know, kind of posts Mongo clips and how awful he was. And but you won't find an account like that about Kevin Green. Mongo became a full-time wrestler for a while. Kevin Green was never full-time. He got in, he got out. But the one thing that everybody had to say about him, if they worked with him, Flair said the same thing. He took it very seriously. He was very respectful. And therefore, he received a lot of respect back from the wrestlers in turn. You know, but it was that match they had. I don't remember what pay-per-view it was, but it was the Legends of the Gridiron against the Legends of the Ring. Mongo turned on Kevin Green when the match was over. I think he hit him with a briefcase or the Halliburton, as they called it, on TV. And that was when Mongo joined the Four Horsemen, which was not one of their brighter decisions. But again, he was very well liked, and he took it seriously, and that earned him the respect of a lot of the people who worked there. And I want to extend my condolences to Dave Meltzer on the loss of his mother, Marilyn, at 91 years old. She was sick for a while and unresponsive in her final weeks. I know that feeling, and it is an awful situation for any child to be in. I don't care how old you are. That is never an easy thing to deal with. I also saw that his son is in the hospital battling a flare-up of Crohn's disease, and his son may also have COVID. So Dave's having a pretty shitty week himself. I hope things get better for him and his family. So I'm going to try to put all that death and darkness aside for the next 90 minutes or couple of hours or so and just talk wrestling. Because like I said, there is a lot to talk about. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is this. WWE hosted its first Slammy Awards in 5 years. This time as an online show with people accepting their awards virtually. And others accepting their Slammies in these pre-taped segments backstage at Raw and SmackDown. I'm going to run through the results, or at least of the main categories, and I'm going to give you my picks along the way. My year-end picks for Wrestler of the Year and so forth. Drew McIntyre was voted by the fans as both overall Superstar of the Year in WWE, as well as Male Superstar of the Year. He beat out Roman Reigns, Randy Orton, Braun Strowman, and The Fiend, Bray Wyatt. And in the overall category, he also beat out Asuka, Sasha Banks, Bayley, Becky Lynch, and Charlotte Flair. The correct answer is either Drew McIntyre or Roman Reigns. And my Superstar of the Year pick for 2020 is Drew McIntyre. But only because Roman Reigns missed 5 months. 5 months is a long time. As great as Roman Reigns has been, Drew has been there the entire year, and really from the very beginning of the year where he won the Royal Rumble. It's been this ascent for him. And I think in the ring, you know, you could talk about ratings and everything, but in the ring certainly, and I think on TV he has delivered in the biggest push of his career. And he is the Superstar of the Year for 2020 in WWE. You know, Roman Reigns is the only thing that really feels somewhat must-see right now on WWE television. But McIntyre, like I said, he's been delivering all year. So you could talk about ratings and everything, but let's be honest, nobody draws ratings in WWE at the moment. Okay, so you can't really put that all on Drew. But from the very first pay-per-view of the year, McIntyre's been killing it, winning the Royal Rumble, beating Brock Lesnar, even though the match was very forgettable because of the circumstances. But he's had great match after great match this year against the likes of Seth Rollins, Bobby Lashley, Randy Orton, Roman Reigns. He delivers more often than not. And I'm glad to see him having the success that he's been having. And, you know, of all the WWE stars, he's the one who has been the most screwed, I think, by this pandemic. And I hope that once fans are back in the buildings, he's able to enjoy it. And it's not just a case of, well, on to the next one. He had his shot this year. Next year, it's a new year. We pick somebody new and we kind of move him off to the side. I hope that's not the case. I hope he's still, if he's not the guy, hopefully he is still in the mix well into next year. Female Superstar of the Year went to Sasha Banks, beating out Asuka, Bayley, Becky Lynch, and Charlotte Flair. You can't go wrong with any of those first three names. I would have picked Bayley. Bayley and Asuka both were two of the MVPs of those early pandemic shows at the Performance Center. And Asuka was all over the shows over the summer, almost to the point of Asuka overload, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But she was, I mean, they relied on her so much. I don't know what they would have done without her. I think that division would have died without Asuka. But Bayley had that long run as the SmackDown Women's Champion, the longest ever, and she turned me around on that character. I wasn't much into it at the beginning of the year, but she really found her groove. She would come out and shit on Michael Cole every week and make comments and poke fun at him, and she would shit-talk her opponents. You could hear everything, right, because there were no fans in the building. So I think the environment actually lent itself very well to her character. I did a total 180 on Bayley. So I would have chosen her for Female Superstar of 2020. The Slammy for Match of the Year went to the Boneyard match at WrestleMania between The Undertaker and AJ Styles, beating out the greatest wrestling match ever between Edge and Randy Orton. I find that very amusing. It also beat out the men's Royal Rumble match, Becky against Asuka from the Rumble, AJ and Daniel Bryan in the finals of the IC tournament, the Styles, Sami Zayn, Jeff Hardy match, ladder match from Clash of Champions, Roman Reigns against Jey Uso, I Quit inside Hell in a Cell, Sasha and Bayley, Hell in a Cell for the SmackDown Women's title, Drew and Roman at Survivor Series, and it also beat out The New Day against The Hurt Business in a match on Raw back on November 16th. I loved the Boneyard match. I think most people did, if you can call it a match. That gets into the whole thing with the Boneyard match and the Money in the Bank matches and the Stadium Stampede in AEW. Are they really matches? I kind of look at the Boneyard match as more of just one giant fight scene, but however you look at it, the Boneyard match was great. It was unique at the time before they went into cinematic overload. And it gave The Undertaker a chance to go out on a high note, at least until he comes back for the next match. You know, it headlined the first night of WrestleMania, and there is no bigger spot in WWE than the main event of WrestleMania. But of the choices given, it was not the match of the year. I believe WWE Match of the Year honors of the choices that were given from that list I just read off to you belong to Sasha Banks and Bayley at Hell in a Cell for the SmackDown Women's title. The greatest women's Hell in a Cell match, and there haven't been that many of them, but the greatest women's Hell in a Cell match the WWE has ever produced. The story was built up. You talk about long-term storytelling. The story was built up over such an extended period of time. And those two women, much like Asuka, the whole summer, were all over TV. Right? Tag team champions they were as well. And everything fed back into the story until Bayley, you know, turned on Sasha finally. And it led to their match at Hell in a Cell. Now, I had hoped they could find a way to extend it to WrestleMania in a stadium in front of an audience, which they could still do, but you can't go back and, you know, the genie is out of the bottle, right? It wasn't the first match they've ever had in their careers, but it really was the first match of this new program. You can't go back and undo that. You can't do the first match over again. I'm not sure there's a real need now to go back and do it. So I was kind of hoping they would find a way, but they felt they had to go to it now, and they couldn't afford to delay it anymore. And they knocked it out of the park. They went in there, they had an outstanding match, they knocked it out of the park. I still don't think it topped their NXT match in Brooklyn, which was about as close to perfect as you can get. But there was no way they could, you know, it's almost unfair to even compare. There's no way they could have matched that atmosphere. One has people, the other doesn't. Two totally different circumstances. So they were never going to, in my mind, they were never going to top that. But I would have given the Slammy to the two of them. Now that does not mean that it is the match of the year in WWE or anywhere else for that matter. That's the match of the year based on the choices presented in the Slammy Awards. I'm going to run through my list of the top 10 matches of 2020, WWE and otherwise, next Sunday. First sound off of the new year, episode 685. We'll do the top 10 list on that show. Edge versus Randy Orton won for Rivalry of the Year. They beat out Seth Rollins and the Mysterio family. Drew McIntyre against Randy Orton, Sasha Banks against Bayley, R-Truth against The World, and Lana against the announce tables, Hardy Har Har. That's fine. You know, Edge and Orton is fine. Either that or Sasha versus Bayley. Either one of those I think would have been acceptable. Sasha and Bayley actually weren't feuding, though, for very long. Not until the turn happened. So giving it to Edge and Orton I think makes sense. The Street Profits won Tag Team of the Year over the Golden Role Models, Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler, Shinsuke Nakamura and Cesaro, and The New Day. Return of the Year went to Edge over Roman Reigns, MVP, Sami Zayn, and Goldberg. It should have been Roman. It should have been Roman Reigns. Edge's return should have won for the moment of the year. They had a separate category for moment of the year. That's where Edge should have won. And instead that went to The Undertaker's farewell. Edge returning at the Royal Rumble was a great moment. It got a great reaction. And it was a nice surprise. You know, even though his name was rumored, it was still a surprise. It was a surprise when his music hit and he came out and he was back in his gear for the first time in 9 years. But, you know, Roman Reigns, he came back, and then a week later, he won the Universal title. And he has gone on to become one of the few things worth watching on TV. So in my book, Roman Reigns is the return of the year. And that was the end of the fan-voted awards. They had the best trash talkers of the year. That went to The Hurt Business for the men. It went to Lacey Evans for the women. WWE Network Documentary of the Year was The Undertaker Last Ride series, which, of course, Charles Robinson was named Referee of the Year. Most Creative 24/7 Finish, for those who care, Drew Gulak dressing up as a janitor to beat up R-Truth for the title. Best Ring Gear went to New Day. They picked New Day for Best Ring Gear over Sasha Banks. That is a crime. Musical Performance of the Year went to Elias. Breakout Star was the Street Profits, and Social Media Superstar of the Year goes to Bayley. Celebrity Appearance of the Year. Rob Gronkowski. A terrible choice. And if they had any guts, they would have included NXT in these awards. And Pat McAfee would have won. Pat McAfee was the clear winner. I understand he wasn't main roster, but I don't care. You talk about Celebrity Appearance of the Year. Pat McAfee trounces Rob Gronkowski in that department. And Double Cross of the Year was Bayley turning on Sasha Banks. So those were your Slammy Awards for 2020. Again, next Sunday I'll do my top 10 list of the top 10 matches, mine, of the year. You may have your own. And that'll be on next week's show, episode 685. So tune in then. Roll Call continues. Again, your support this month has been amazing. Dastardly Derek Smith, the Carolina Panther Bradley Gooch, Ostentatious Alan Carter, Josh Bad Medicine Medina, New York punk Arnold Modesto, Chris Killswitch Coopler, Luis the Belmont Sentinel Alejandro, who joined us for the NXT stream the other night. Another unforgettable appearance. Brett Brickfist Brode, who just turned 36. Happy birthday, brother. Gravedigger Ismael Flores, first-time donator. Welcome to the crew. The Wichita workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. Clayton is celebrating a birthday this Wednesday, and I want to take a moment to wish him a very happy birthday. Thanks for being a fan, and I hope you have a terrific new year. Belt fan Brent Banner of the How Did We Even Get Here podcast. He and his co-host Trey are doing something special for the holidays. This past week, Brent took over with a review of the Netflix movie Jingle Jangle. I didn't even know such a movie existed. And Trey is taking over for New Year's Eve. And whoever is weak, whichever show gets the most traffic, the most views, the most listens, that person's going to win a new championship belt. So find them on all podcast platforms on Thursdays by searching How Did We Even Get Here or on YouTube at tinyurl.com/gethere-tube. Also want to give a very quick shout out to Marissa, who has a brand new Christmas vlog going up on her YouTube channel Tuesday morning. She got a new car for Christmas and somebody filmed her reaction. So show her some love. You can check it out at youtube.com/MarissaJonason, JonasOn. The legends are coming. I feel like Paul Revere, but Paul Revere never did say the British are coming. That's false. That was made up over the years. He never said such a thing. But I will say the legends are coming. WWE is trotting out Hulk Hogan, who I saw got a brand new Dodge Red Eye from Santa this Christmas. Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Kurt Angle, Big Show, Booker T, Beth Phoenix, Tori Wilson, Jacqueline, Mickey James, who has apparently been moved from the active roster to the legends list, legend status, Sergeant Slaughter, Tatanka, Jeff Jarrett, Jimmy Hart, Ivory, Carlito, Melina, The Boogeyman, Mark Henry, IRS, Alicia Fox, Hillbilly Jim, and Michael P.S. Hayes. We'll all be live on USA for Legends Night on January 4th, the first Raw of the new year. You know, I used to love me some good old school Raw from time to time. I used to love those shows. And I still like seeing the legends from time to time when they trot them out. Of course, they always trot them out for the same bad comedy. They don't really do much with them. But they've gone to this well over the years several times now. And each time, it's kind of the law of diminishing returns in terms of the ratings bump that they get. Doesn't really work as well anymore. Funny thing about that January 4th date, it was January 4th, 2010. Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair debuted on TNA Impact. And here we are on what will be 11 years to the day. WWE, in a panic over their record low ratings, are trotting out who else but Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair to begin their new year. So Vince McMahon's answer is to rev up the old DeLorean and travel back in time to generate interest. Their tried and true formula. And it may work for one night, but unless they have a big angle plan to really hook people into tuning in the following week, this will not work. You're not fooling anybody. Now, what that angle would even be, I don't know, but whatever that angle is, it would give us a good picture of the direction I think that Raw is going in heading into the Royal Rumble. Maybe it's a big call-up from NXT. Maybe it's a big heel turn. Remember what they did on Raw 1000 many years ago? They trotted out legends for that show too. In fact, that was the first of the full-time 3-hour episodes of Raw. Big CM Punk heel turn at the end of the show. Happened that night. depending on who it is and how it's done, that could be a big angle they could shoot. Or maybe it's nothing at all. And it literally is just, we got to get the ratings up. Let's bring all the big names back for one night. But all I could do when I saw the ad for this show, when I saw the commercial for it come on, I just shook my head. Because what can you do? What other reaction could you have at this point? But hey, smack my ass and call me Sally. We're getting Jeff Jarrett and Hillbilly Jim. Happy New Year. The Hardy Bros lost to Bobby Lashley and MVP. Jeff Hardy again tapped out to the Hurt Lock. I'd like to draw your attention, though, to the promo earlier in the show that set this match up. Matt and Jeff interrupted a Hurt Business promo with one of their own. This is one of the biggest problems I have with this show. The dialogue. I'm not sure what audience this dialogue is supposed to be aimed at. I was going to say 7-year-olds, but some of the words and some of the references, a 7-year-old would know what it means. You know, and I don't know that anybody over the age of 12 would actually believe that any of this sounded cool. So again, I'm not sure exactly who this is meant to appeal to, but here's Matt Riddle. This is what he said. He said, "Hey, bros. Congratulations on a big win last night, and I'm really digging the celebration, but I feel like you're doing a couple of things wrong, you know? Like, why are you spending so much money at the club? You don't need to be buying fancy bottles of champagne. What you need to be doing is just chilling out and relaxing with the homies. Maybe huck the disc in the backyard. Maybe grill up some tasty treats. Get a little toasted, and then maybe listen to the Joe Rogan podcast, or maybe watch a Dave Chappelle comedy special and escape the day-to-day existential grind that life is. You know what I'm saying? And there's no reason to spread negativity and being bullies, because at the end of the day, we're all the same. We're all self-aware carbon matter that's on a rock hurling through the void of space. So why don't y'all just chill out?" Someone wrote that. I want y'all to realize that. Someone wrote that dialogue. Someone submitted their resume for a writing position with the hope that WWE would pay them for what I just read to you. And this is what they put down on a piece of paper. And worse, it was approved. Someone then had to look at that piece of paper and say, "Yup, that sounds good." Then we had Jeff Hardy trying to translate. Said what he's trying to say here is there are more important things in life than status and money. Because a man's character is the only criterion of wealth, you know? So we'd rather die full of our pride rather than live a life of greed. But look, man, if we're going to beat Bobby and MVP tonight, we've got to fight with the one thing that's worth a lot more than anything they could ever buy. Our faith, bro. You know what it's like? It's like they're trying to write for a comic book instead of trying to write for two living, breathing human beings. I think some of these people might be better off going and writing for Marvel or DC than they would for WWE. Because this just ain't work. During a Miz TV segment with AJ Styles and Omos, AJ's bodyguard pointed out that it was John Morrison who technically cashed in Money in the Bank at TLC, not Miz. And Miz realized that he was right, and he demanded that his briefcase be reinstated. I don't know if it will be or not, but thankfully he was, because that was my fear. If you remember when I did the TLC review last Sunday, I said, now I thought I didn't hear a bell ring after Miz cashed in. So I thought it would be on a technicality. Oh, the bell never rang, therefore it's not official. Give me back my briefcase. This is a different way of trying to get the briefcase back on Miz. So I don't know if that's what they're going to do or not. Thankfully, Drew McIntyre interrupted before anything could happen, and he read what he called the nightmare after TLC. Read this off a napkin. He had crib notes. And then Sheamus walked out, and he read a passage from the story. And then Keith Lee came out, and he read a passage from the story. The babyfaces got in the ring. They cleaned house on the heels while Omos just stood outside. What's the point of having a bodyguard if he's just going to stand there every week while you get your ass kicked? It's a terrible bodyguard. I'm starting to realize why they just had him playing doorman on Raw Underground for Shane McMahon. This guy is not very good at bodyguarding. AJ drop-kicked Keith Lee into Sheamus as Sheamus was setting up for a brogue kick, and that kicked off this big pull-apart where Drew McIntyre had to get between them and separate them before they came to blows. I am still enjoying the stuff involving Drew and Sheamus, and now Keith Lee is getting involved. It's the other 2 hours and 45 minutes of these shows that I have a problem with. T-Bar of Retribution beat Ricochet. He then told Ricochet to join them or they will end his existence. I think Vince McMahon is already well on his way to doing that himself. I don't think he needs T-Bag's help. But I have to defend Ricochet on one thing. People were making fun of this guy for crying and tearing up and getting all emotional on Raw Talk on Monday night. They were mocking this guy. And he was on Raw Talk talking about constantly losing. Week after week, talking about how he's so low right now that he has to consider Retribution's offer. You know, if you would have said this weeks ago, the answer would have been no, but I have to actually think about this now. And you can see how it's just tormenting him. It's tearing him up inside. He was showing real emotion during this segment. His eyes were all red. As far as I could tell, Matt Riddle wasn't around, so you can't blame him. But he ran down his entire list of failures for this year. Not being able to hold on to the United States Championship for more than a couple of weeks. He says, I couldn't even touch Brock Lesnar. He couldn't beat the Hurt Business. Now I can't beat Retribution. So he said something has to change. But he said he doesn't know what that is yet. He thinks he's getting there. He's getting close. But he hasn't quite figured out what it is. But he was at a loss for words. He was stumbling over his words. But it worked in this case. It felt like this is a man. It felt real. It felt like this is a guy who is totally lost and is searching for the answers and can't find it. And just does not know what to do with himself. And you know, when you listen to him run down his resume like that for 2020, you realize how bad of a year he really had. I mean, I knew it was bad, but Jesus Christ. Look at what they have done to poor Ricochet. Or as R-Truth called him, because R-Truth was on the set with Charlie Caruso. He was trying to give Ricochet a pep talk and lift his spirits. He called him Richard O'Shea. This guy had R-Truth sitting next to him, and he had every reason in the world to crack and to corpse, as a lot of other people do when they're on Raw Talk and they have to deal with R-Truth. He's always trying to make people crack up. He made Brock Lesnar crack up in the middle of the ring on live TV once. R-Truth is great. But he had R-Truth sitting next to him, giving him every reason to start corpsing on this show, and he never cracked, not once. He was in the zone. Ricochet was really good here. And I think a lot of the hate and the jokes and everything were unwarranted. They were not warranted. I thought he did a good job here. And there is not a doubt in my mind that the reason he was so good in this segment is because what you saw, that was real emotion pouring out of that guy. Ricochet is not that good of an actor. He knows that he has had a shit year. He cannot be happy with the way that things have gone for him in WWE. And like he said here, he cannot continue to be the one that other people step over to further their own careers. That's what he said. One of the reasons I like this segment so much, and I think people, again, unfairly mocked it,
is because everything you heard him say, you can believe that that is how he really feels. And that is how it came across on TV. It came across as genuine. It came across as the complete opposite of people like Matt Riddle and Jeff Hardy, who sound like a couple of cartoon characters. This felt real. It sounded real. Authenticity is what is sorely lacking from Monday Night Raw. And you got some of that here in this segment with Ricochet. Now, the problem is that he is still involved with Retribution. And to get him to wherever he's going, if Retribution is sort of the bridge to that, if it's a quick thing, then okay, fine. But the longer I feel like he's entangled with Retribution, the worse off he's going to be. Retribution has been a failure. And it's not fair to the people involved who didn't ask for this. I'm not blaming Donovan Dijak. I'm not blaming Mia Yim. Or Dio Madden or any of the people who were involved in this. They're trying to make the most of a bad situation, but make no mistake, it is a bad situation. Mercedes Martinez had enough self-respect to back out and say, I don't want to be part of this. I've been in the wrestling business for 20 years. I'm not going to have the stain of this shit on me. And she stepped away and she asked to go back to NXT. And she just returned to NXT this week. In fact, she was on NXT attacking the champion. She was the smart one. But as long as he is linked to Retribution, whether he joins them or not, nothing will change for Ricochet. He needs a total reset. And this promo gives them the perfect excuse to do that reset. Ricochet has never been at a lower point in his career. If ever there was a time for him to adopt more of a silent, brooding character, now is that time. I mean, I'm thinking Sting-like or Darby Allin. You want to draw a comparison, then go ahead. I'm not saying paint his face and make him the next Sting. I'm just saying that dark, brooding character. Just think back to Sting for a second, okay? Why did Sting go from Surfer Sting and all the colors on his face to the Crow character? Why did he withdraw and become an introvert and rarely speak for a year and a half? Remember the promo he cut on Nitro? Because there was a promo that led to that character change. It was because his own friends, Lex Luger, and all the members of the WCW roster, they didn't believe him. They actually thought that he was with the NWO, that he was against them, that he would betray WCW, and it was like a fake Sting, and it wasn't him. But that bothered him, it offended him, that people would think, that his own friends would think that about him. And that was what kind of triggered the character reset, and we got a totally new Sting, who said, you know what, I don't want to have anything to do with any of you people. I'm on my own. I could tell I'm on my own here. I don't have any friends. I don't have any allies. Nobody believes me. Nobody, you know what? Screw all of you. Ricochet right now is searching for a reason. He's never been at a lower point. He gets his ass kicked every week. He's got no friends left. He's got nowhere else to go other than just joining. If you can't beat him, join him. Well, joining Retribution, believe me, that ain't the answer. So if ever there was a time for a reset to that type of character who just withdraws and says very little, if anything, now is that time. He doesn't speak. He sits off in the crowd. I mean, I guess with the Thunderdome, he can't exactly go up into the stands. But he has no friends. He has no allies. And when he wrestles, he needs to adopt a more aggressive style. And the best comparison I can make is somebody he's very familiar with. In fact, the match he had with this man, I think, is the match that got them noticed by WWE and got them a job, or it got Pac a job many years ago, and that's Pac. When you watch Pac physically is not the biggest man in the world. But if you ask me, can I see Pac one day as the AEW World Champion, as I look ahead and I look at their roster and I try to see, okay, who can be the World Champion one day? You know, Kenny Omega has it right now. I think Hangman Page is a given. I think Darby Allin can get there one day. Pac is on that list. Absolutely. Could I buy into him as being a world champion, even though he's not 6 feet tall or 6 foot five? Absolutely.
Because when he's in the ring, he's got a very aggressive style. He's got this scowl on his face. I mean, they call him the bastard when he comes out. Looks like he's always pissed off of the world. But he lays his shit in. You know, his stuff in the ring, it looks good. So he's the closest thing that I could think of to what I'm talking about here. You know, Ricochet, promo-wise, is not a good promo. This was the exception because it felt he tapped into something real. He wasn't just reading rehearsed lines off a page that were given to him or bad jokes. I mean, let's be honest, the minute, as good as this was, the minute he's back on Raw in a regular segment on TV, it's back to the bad dialogue. I mean, it's just not his strong suit. He does not do well with it. This is a way to get the microphone out of his hand. Let his work in the ring do the talking. This would not be the case for just anybody. Some people, you need to put a microphone in their hand. Because in the ring, there's nothing that, maybe they're not a bad wrestler, but there's really nothing that sets them apart from everybody else. So you need them to do a sit-down interview or try to flesh out the character a little bit more. You don't have to do that with Ricochet. Ricochet is a different kind of cat. He's a different kind of performer. There ain't nobody like Ricochet in WWE. The things that he could do, the things that you see him doing on TV, that's half of what this guy is capable of doing. But this is how you begin to rehab Ricochet. Hide his weakness, accentuate his strengths, and his strength is that until he got to WWE, he was the best high flyer in the business. Now you might say Rey Fénix or someone like that has now taken the mantle from him, but before he came to WWE, Ricochet was the guy. When you thought of these guys who do all the aerial stuff and fly around the ring and do all these amazing things, everybody talked about Ricochet. Everybody was wondering, where's Ricochet going to land? Where is he going to go? That's what he was known for. He was like a walking video game character. He could do things that nobody else could do. Or as some of you would say, yes, he was a flippy wrestler. He was the quintessential flippy wrestler. But if you're going to be a flippy wrestler, then guess what? Be the best damn flippy wrestler of them all. And that's what he was. If you had somebody who wasn't a wrestling fan and they were flipping, no pun intended, but if they were flipping through the channels and they came across Raw and they saw the Ricochet of old, I guarantee you they would stop, at least for a few seconds or a few minutes, they would stop and be like, whoa, what the hell was that? Like, that was cool. Like Rey Mysterio did for a lot of people 25 years ago, the way he would fly around the ring. You would put the remote down. You didn't want to change the channel if Rey Mysterio was on the screen. Everybody talks glowingly about the Cruiserweight division in WCW during the Monday Night War. Why do you think that is? They brought a lot of talented people in, but it was Rey Mysterio. That's what got people hooked. Because there was nobody like him at that time on TV. Vince McMahon never got Ricochet because, as I've already explained, he does not watch NXT. And he sure as shit never watched any of Ricochet's pre-WWE stuff. So he doesn't get it. He doesn't understand. Ricochet needs to, you know, the character needs to toughen up, start really laying his shit in, keep his mouth shut, keep that hoodie on, sit and observe. And keep people guessing. What's he thinking about? What's on his mind? Is he a bad guy? Is he a good guy? What's the deal with Ricochet? You know what? He's neither one of those things. Keep people guessing for a while. But if they just throw him into Retribution, or they just keep him feuding with Retribution, even if he finally wins in the end, it's right back to main event and matches with Drew Gulak. It is a waste of the man's talents. And it's going to take time to educate people because all they've seen this year with Ricochet is failure. They associate him now with failure. Now you need to rebuild his credibility. And I just told you how to do it. After burning the Fiend alive at TLC, the Firefly Inferno match, this feud looks like it may actually be continuing. Now, normally, if someone were burned alive, I would say that that would be the payoff
But maybe the Burning Alive thing will lead to a straight wrestling match with a roll-up finish. Alexa Bliss was back. She was swinging on a swing set that suddenly appeared in the ring when the lights came back on. She warned Orton that if the Fiend does come back, it will be like nothing he has ever seen before. And they close with Drew McIntyre, Sheamus, and Keith Lee against AJ Styles, The Miz, and John Morrison in a holiday street fight with people tagging in and out, like any ordinary tag team match. I mean, it's a street fight. What is the referee going to do, right? If you just get in there and start to double or triple team the other guy, what's he going to do? There's no disqualifications in a street fight. I mean, better yet, you just put the referee through a table and then go on with your business. No DQs. McIntyre was setting up for the finish on Miz with a Claymore when Sheamus reached in, tagged himself in, wants to get the glory, but then Keith Lee tagged himself in. And Sheamus wasn't happy about that, and Keith Lee got the win for his team with a spirit bomb. Sheamus gave Lee a brogue kick after the match, and McIntyre started yelling at him, "What are you doing? I vouched for you. Come on, I told him that you were cool." And Sheamus just stared. He just stared at Drew as they went off the air. Things are not well at the moment. And look, like I said before, as far as Monday Night Raw is concerned, I am at least digging the main story. I'm trying to be fair with this show. I am trying to be fair with this show, but the show is just so bad in so many other ways. It is begging for something fresh in the new year that, sadly, based on this whole Legends Night theme they're stocking up on for January 4th, it doesn't look like it's coming anytime soon. Watching SmackDown this week, I can't understand how the same company could be responsible for producing both of these shows in the same week. But before I get to SmackDown, I have a very important message I want all of you to hear. It is the final podcast of 2020, and we are about to start a brand new year, and there is no better time than the present time to cut the cord and tell your cable company to go kick rocks. I did it with mine, and it was the best decision I ever made. FuboTV is all you need. You pay less money for more channels. What's not to like? FuboTV brings you over 100 channels, cloud DVR, and absolutely no hidden fees. Did I mention you pay less than you would for cable? Can't mention that enough. You know, it was amusing to me how my cable company groveled. They literally begged me on the phone to stay once I made the call to cut the cord, and they realized how serious I was about breaking up with them, and they realized I wasn't just looking for some discount. They could have given me 5 discounts, and I still would have been paying more than what you will pay each month for FuboTV. Cable companies have gotten away with this for far too long because people didn't have options, but now they do. With FuboTV, you get everything you need, including all your favorite shows and sports, which is where Fubo really shines. All the live sports you can handle with the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, college sports, and more. And right now, FuboTV is offering our listeners a free trial and 15% off your first month by going to FuboTV.com/Solomonster. There are no contracts, and you can cancel anytime. Go to FuboTV.com/Solomonster for 15% off your first month and a free trial. That's FuboTV.com/Solomonster. Let's talk about this Christmas SmackDown, and let's talk about the Royal Rumble and what things are looking like in terms of potential winners for the Royal Rumble matches, because it's becoming a little bit clearer now what the realistic options are. SmackDown, they knew that they were going to have a lot of eyes on this show this week because they had a lead-in from the NFL, and that never happens, a direct lead-in from an NFL game. If only they would treat all of their shows the way they treat one that has a lead-in from the NFL, we'd be getting a lot better shows. They also loaded the show with three title matches, which I'm sure didn't hurt, one of which was a steel cage match that they gave away on TV. With the NFL lead-in, they were rewarded with a huge rating spike. SmackDown did 3.3 million overnight viewers. Final numbers are not in yet. That is their biggest audience since the SmackDown premiere on Fox over a year ago. They averaged 4 million viewers for hour one. That's the good news. The bad news is they fell almost 40% for hour two with 2.5 million viewers, which is still higher than what they've been doing. In 18 to 49, they trailed only the NBA game on NBC, and they beat out everything else on network TV. So it was a good night for SmackDown, a good night for WWE, and they were smart. I give them credit for this. They were smart because they opened the show with the cage match for the Universal title between Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens. They went right into what they knew would be the biggest attraction. What is going to get people's attention? Two things. Number one, you put a steel cage around the ring. And number two, you put your top champion, which is really what Roman Reigns is. I mean, let's be honest. He's positioned as the guy in WWE. Looks the part, right? Comes out. Looks like a badass. That cage and Roman Reigns was the first thing that people saw. If you were tuned into the NFL game and you kept your TV on Fox, those are the first two things you saw. So they were smart to open the show with it and have Roman come out first. And they had another very good match. Their second of the week coming off their TLC match, which I thought was better than this, but this was very good too. And Roman Reigns retained his championship after Jey Uso provided the assist. He came down late in the match. He reached through a hole because they cut these holes in the cage. He reached through a hole in the cage. He handcuffed Kevin Owens to the cage. And Kevin Owens had the match won at that point, but now he's cuffed. And he's trying to fit his body through the door. His feet won't quite reach the floor. He's screwed. And Roman Reigns looks at him and he kind of smirks and he realizes that he can't get out. And Roman does the slow walk out the door, down the steps, touches the floor, and Roman Reigns retains the Universal title. Owens the whole time is just yelling at him. Your family would be disappointed in you. He called him a bitch over and over again. That makes back-to-back matches where Kevin Owens can make the argument that he had the match won. He had the title won were it not for the interference of Jey Uso. And so it looks like, it's not official, but it looks like we are probably headed to a third and final match of the Royal Rumble between Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens. Now, this would not be the first time that Owens and Reigns wrestled for the Universal title at the Royal Rumble. They did it in 2017, and if you remember the stipulation for that match, the stipulation had Chris Jericho suspended above the ring in a shark cage to prevent him from getting involved, which he did anyway, but that's why he was hanging above the ring, to stop him from interfering. Could we see the same with Jey Uso? It seems like we're headed that way. Jey Uso constantly is getting involved. You've tried putting a cage around these two. He still got involved. How else are you going to keep Jey Uso out of this match unless you just threaten to suspend him? You could just say that Jey Uso is barred from ringside. I don't know why they don't just do that. But I think it's more likely he's involved in some way, but he has to be neutralized. He has to be contained. We could see literally right down to the stip and the same title being defended, only the roles this time are reversed. But we could see the exact same match take place at the exact same pay-per-view 4 years later. Charlotte and Asuka, they are the new women's tag team champions. Charlotte Flair, to the surprise of no one, was the big mystery partner for Asuka, TLC, last Sunday. And they retained their titles in a triple threat elimination match over Bayley and Carmella and the team of Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair. Sasha pinned Bayley with a frog splash to eliminate her team. And Bianca took the losing fall to Charlotte and natural selection. You weren't going to pin the SmackDown Women's Champion, so Sasha wasn't going to get pinned. So Bianca had to be the one to eat the fall. Not really that big of a deal. She looked good. She looked strong. She was made to look
on the same level. She did not look out of place in there with Charlotte and all these other top names in the division. Daniel Bryan beat Jey Uso. There's Jey Uso. Jey Uso's been all over these shows. I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens when Jimmy comes back. If they split time between them, they both do singles matches. Do they just go right back to nothing but tag team matches? Because Jimmy was hoping in August to come back by January. Well, we're only days away from January. But Daniel Bryan beat Jey Uso. Very good match. Backstage later on, Bryan declared himself the first entrant into the 2021 Royal Rumble match. More on that in a second. And in the main event, Big E beat Sami Zayn in a lumberjack match to become the new Intercontinental Champion for the second time in his career. Been many years since Big E was the Intercontinental Champion. Long before New Day is when Big E last held that title. Sami tried to crawl away as the lumberjacks were all fighting with each other, but Apollo Crews, kind of funny, he ran after him and tackled him on the stage. All the lumberjacks then picked up Sami, carried him back, put him in the ring, and Big E finished him off with the big ending. The babyfaces all hoisted Big E up on their shoulders, and there was a big confetti celebration. Confetti rained down from the ceiling. This Friday on New Year's Day, Big E defends the Intercontinental title for the first time against Baron Corbin. And Seth Rollins will make his return to TV for the first time since Survivor Series. A very good episode of SmackDown this week, but let's talk about the Royal Rumble. It's Royal Rumble season, and no matter how bad WWE may be each year or may not be, right? They have good years, they have bad years, they have good rumbles, they have absolutely dreadful rumbles. As an old school fan, I always look forward to the Royal Rumble. I always look forward to Royal Rumble season. I put my hands together and I hope that they don't screw it up. It can be hard to screw up the Royal Rumble, but they've done it before. But it is a time of year where people, I think, generally get more excited and start thinking about the possibilities in terms of who's going to win and who's going to go on to WrestleMania and headline and all this different stuff. So I thought what we would do here is, you know, with the Kevin Owens program clearly being extended to the Royal Rumble, let us take a look at the list of potential winners for the Royal Rumble match. You have heard me float Big E's name quite a bit over the last few months. Big E started getting a big push, and it looked like he was going to probably be feuding over the Intercontinental title, and then they kind of got away from it a little bit, and I'm like, all right, well, maybe they're actually thinking bigger with Big E. And I said that I would like to see him. He was my pick to win the men's Royal Rumble match. Someone new who has never won a Rumble before, and it would vault him into a prime position against Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. Well, now with Big E winning the Intercontinental title, that pretty much takes him out of the running for the spot. I think any hope of Big E being the one to win the Royal Rumble is pretty much dead at this point. So I think Big E is off the list. So who else, realistically, could win the Royal Rumble? You look at Sheamus. He is clearly headed for a match with his best friend. I don't know if it's going to happen at WrestleMania. I don't know if it's going to happen at the Royal Rumble. They need somebody for Drew McIntyre at the Royal Rumble. Maybe it's Sheamus at the Rumble and again at WrestleMania. Maybe they do the match. Friendly competition between two friends. Sheamus loses, he snaps. Or Sheamus kind of, you know, cheats to win. And then Drew has to win the belt back from his friend. You could get two matches out of it. Sure. I mean, look, they're getting three out of Owens and Reigns. So I think it makes it less likely that Sheamus wins the Rumble match. I think there's more of a likelihood of him challenging for the championship at the Rumble, more than there is of him being in the actual Rumble match. And the idea of Sheamus being the one to win the Rumble, I'm not really enamored with that idea. Then we have Keith Lee. A lot of people pulling for Keith Lee to win the Royal Rumble match. It would be cool. Lee had a brief but impressive showing in this year's Rumble match when he went toe-to-toe with Brock Lesnar briefly. And he is in the mix right now. He has been part of this storyline involving Drew and Sheamus on TV. He was in the main event on Monday night. Keith Lee and Drew McIntyre would be two babyfaces one-on-one for the title. I don't see them doing it. Maybe a triple threat, maybe a three-way also involving Sheamus. But for that reason, I don't see a Keith Lee win here as being very likely. Then we have Seth Rollins. Just mentioned that Seth Rollins is on his way back. He's going to be making his big return to SmackDown this week. I expect him, as far as what's he coming back for. Let us hope it's not to continue the Mysterio feud. I think he's going to declare his entry into the Royal Rumble match. And you have to think that to Vince McMahon and WWE, it's got to be appealing for them to want to do a battle of the two former Shield members, the two remaining Shield members they have on their roster. Especially if Rollins drops the Messiah stuff, which I don't think is going to happen just yet, but if he dropped it and went back to being a babyface, then it would make more sense to program him with Roman Reigns just from a heel face dynamic. But I think Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns should be kept far apart for at least many, many, many more months. I have no interest in that as a WrestleMania main event. Been there, done that. To me, it hasn't been long enough yet. There's time to do it. Now is not that time. What about Brock Lesnar? Brock Lesnar is not, as far as we know, currently under contract with WWE. In fact, pictures have been surfacing of Brock with this big bushy beard. He's probably living the life right now up in the mountains somewhere, just killing anything that moves. And he probably doesn't even have any interest in going back. He's got all the money he needs. Why would he come back? Why would he come back with no fans? But money talks. And as the ratings continue to plummet, Vince McMahon gets even more desperate. He's trotting out the legends this week. Aside from The Rock, because we know Stone Cold is pretty much retired, there is nobody that Vince can really bring back, a big, big star, other than Brock Lesnar. And he's done it before. Who's to say he won't do it again? Tis the season. It is WrestleMania season is almost upon us. If ever there was a time that Vince would want to bring back Brock Lesnar, now is that time. Especially with the ratings tanking on Monday nights. They always go back to the big names. That is his MO. So what if Brock Lesnar was a surprise entry in the Royal Rumble? And he won, and then that gives Paul Heyman a man on SmackDown and a man on Raw. Right? He's got his hands in both brands. And we get Lesnar against McIntyre at Raymond James Stadium as it was supposed to happen this year. Could they do it? Oh, yeah. Do I want to see it? I don't. Here's something I want to see even less. Bill Goldberg winning the Royal Rumble. Something he's never done before. He's been in the Rumble before, but he's never won the Royal Rumble. I suppose if he was in it, that would count as part of one of his two matches, he says, that he is contracted for each of the next 2 years. So they would only have him left for one match after that. I don't know if they want to waste the Bill Goldberg match on the Royal Rumble. But the teases have already begun, with Goldberg openly talking about wanting the match. Georgia versus Georgia Tech, Spear versus Spear, the match that was supposed to happen this year but didn't. It would be a terrible move to have Goldberg win the Royal Rumble and challenge Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. Awful. But think about it like this, if you're Vince McMahon. Without any fans in the buildings for the foreseeable future, I am sure they're going to try to get people in that stadium for WrestleMania. They are not going to do an empty stadium WrestleMania. But they may not get people back in the buildings before then. So I look at Vince McMahon and what he might be thinking. And without any fans in the buildings between now and then, including the Royal Rumble, they wouldn't have to worry about the Boo Birds, would they? If this were any other year, and they were thinking about doing this, and Bill Goldberg showed up in the Rumble, just showing up in the Rumble, let alone winning it, I think the fans would burn that building to the ground.
They would hijack the show even worse than they did 5 or 6 years ago. Don't have that problem now, because you got virtual fans. You control the fans. You control the audience reaction. You want Goldberg to come out and get a big pop? He gets a big pop. You want him to get the mother of all ovations when he wins the match? Hey, push a button. It's as simple as that. You don't have to worry about hijacking. You don't have to worry about booing. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. They could do that and get away with it if they really wanted to. But I think it would be a terrible idea. And I think now that Big E is out of the picture, kind of given up on that, there's only one man who makes sense for the spot as the winner of the Royal Rumble. And they started that story on Friday night. And that man is Daniel Bryan. A man who admits that he is pretty close to being as part-time as you can be. I mean, he's closer to the end of his career than he is the beginning of it. But Daniel Bryan is the only name that makes sense. Bryan became the first man on Friday night to enter the Royal Rumble match. He says it is the only thing he has never done in his career. Of all the cool things he would love to do, he has never won the Royal Rumble. In fact, he said, he was on Talking Smack, he said that he's never even won in 20 plus years in the business. He has never even so much as won a Battle Royal. And so he is making it his goal in the new year to win his very first Royal Rumble. And he turned to Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman has been on the show every week now. Paul Heyman has had some very memorable segments on Talking Smack recently with Big E, with Kevin Owens. And now you can add another one onto the list with Daniel Bryan. And Heyman doesn't even say much, but it's his presence, it's his facial reactions, it's how other people play off of him. It's been great. It's made for some very compelling TV. TV that unfortunately doesn't air on Fox, but it's still been very good. And Daniel Bryan turned to Paul Heyman. He said, "This may be my last chance." He says, "If I win, that means I go on to WrestleMania to meet the Universal Champion, which right now is Roman Reigns. And if that man is Roman Reigns, I'm going to beat Roman Reigns." He says, "And if it's not Roman Reigns, if Roman Reigns is not the Universal Champion of WrestleMania, then at some point when we do meet, I'll beat him anyway." He said, "Not only am I a better fighter than Roman Reigns, he's sure as hell a better wrestler than Roman Reigns." So the seeds have been planted. Now imagine them after this going ahead and having Bill Goldberg or even Brock Lesnar win the Royal Rumble. It would be as if they learned absolutely nothing from 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when they first pulled this shit. But my fear is that they feel they may be able to get away with it because, again, there's no fans in the buildings to hijack the show. They're doing themselves no favors by pushing the Bryan narrative on TV again. It feels like deja vu. Here we are again. Bryan going into the Royal Rumble. Unless he's going to win it, it's like these people don't learn. They don't learn from their mistakes. He has to be winning it this time. Why would they put themselves through this again? And tease people and start telling that story only for it not to be him. Now, you could have a situation where Bryan goes all the way to the end of the match and then gets screwed, but somehow ends up working his way into a match with Roman Reigns anyway. Maybe a Raw star wins, and that still keeps the door open for Bryan to challenge Roman Reigns. That could work too. I think at this point, you know, there's no need to be cute. You could just have Bryan win, but sure, you could do that as well. But the point is, Bryan has to be in the mix. This can't just be some kind of red herring, and then you kind of swerve everybody, and then of all people, fucking Goldberg wins the Royal Rumble. You can't be doing that. The story sells itself. There is 5 years of history, going back 5 years, that you can tap into for that match at WrestleMania. So you do Reigns-Owens 3 at the Royal Rumble. Daniel Bryan wins and goes on to WrestleMania to challenge Roman Reigns, and it almost doesn't even matter who wins. It doesn't matter if Daniel Bryan wins or not. He may well go to WrestleMania and not win, but that almost is beside the point. It's the story of who goes there and how you get to that point. And the story is right there for them to tell. So then we shift over to the women. We have the Women's Royal Rumble match. Realistically, who are the potential winners? I assume that they are not going to be mixing Raw and SmackDown with NXT this year coming up. So we don't, you know, we won't be seeing anyone cashing in on Io Shirai the way that Charlotte did with Rhea Ripley. We assume that doesn't happen. Who are the most likely winners? There's four names. There's Charlotte Flair. It looks as if we may be headed to another Charlotte Flair match with Asuka at WrestleMania. Part of that is going to depend on the status of Becky Lynch, and that's another name that I float. Becky Lynch, who just had a baby, and if she wants to come back, and I'm sure Vince McMahon would love to have her back as soon as possible, is it realistic to get her back in the mix by the end of January? I don't know. I don't know what her physical status is at that moment, or how smart that would be, how quickly she could be back in a situation like that. I don't know. But Becky Lynch has absolutely got to be considered on that list of potential Royal Rumble winners as well. Because the Charlotte Asuka direction, see, it's not, nothing is locked in, I don't think, but it seems that would be the likely direction. Becky is also, though, a member of the Raw roster. I think part of it may depend on when or if she comes back. And if Becky does come back, she could be the one to come back and challenge Asuka, or you could do a triple threat. But remember the way that Becky left. Becky made the announcement on Raw that she was pregnant in that very dramatic way. She shared a very emotional moment with Asuka. They were both crying tears of joy on TV. Asuka, when you pulled down the Money in the Bank, you didn't win a shot at the title, you won the title. And she opened the briefcase and there was the belt, and it was this great moment. And so now we come back to the following year. Asuka is still the champion. Becky, though, is ready to come back and take back what's hers. Take back the title that she never lost. She basically gifted the title to Asuka. That is an obvious story that they could tell. Then you have Bayley. Does Bayley, who was the longest reigning SmackDown Women's Champion, dominated the shows through much of 2020 before losing it to Sasha Banks, and had a lot of memorable moments during the pandemic era of Raw and SmackDown. Do you still try to get to the match between Sasha Banks and Bayley, even though you've already done it? You've already done the match. In fact, you did it more than once. Do you then come back around to it again just to give them that WrestleMania match that they've never had? Now, if they wanted to do Sasha and Bayley at WrestleMania, far be it from me to complain. I think they'd go out there and they would absolutely, they would destroy. I think they would have a tremendous match. I don't think they would headline with it. Although if you put them in the main event spot, I think they would deliver. I don't see them doing that, though. I just don't know that you need to do it. And it, you know, I hate to say it because that's the direction I was hoping they were going in, but they've already done the match. They already did the match at Hell in a Cell. You did the title change. Sasha won the championship. She's now proven that she could hold on to it longer than a few weeks. You've already told that story. You've already done it. I don't know that you need to just go right back to it again. Which leads me to the fourth choice and the one who I think is going to win and should win the Women's Royal Rumble, and that is Bianca Belair. She has been wrestling Bayley recently. She's lost a few matches, but they've largely kept her strong. Again, I saw her in the ring with all the, you know, the top names on Friday night, and she didn't look out of place at all. I think if you're looking for a new name, I mean, maybe Daniel Bryan on the men's side is not exactly a fresh new name to win the Rumble, even though he's never won it before. He's been around for years. Bianca, though, is a fresh new name. She's very good, and I think you could begin to tell that story of building her to WrestleMania and a match with Sasha Banks. That is the money match. The WrestleMania match, I think, even more than Sasha Bayley. The money match, the match I want to see, is Sasha Banks defending against Bianca Belair. And to do that, I think Bianca Belair should win the Women's Royal Rumble. So these are kind of early, I guess early predictions are just kind of an early look at who I think the most realistic options are. As of this moment, we're still in 2020. We're not even in the new year yet. I may change my mind in a few weeks based on the booking on TV. But that's my thoughts on how things are shaping up for the Royal Rumble matches. And feel free to hit me up on Twitter. Chime in. Let me know what you think. Or if I put this clip up on YouTube, I'm sure there'll be a lot of comments
Do you agree? Do you disagree? Am I missing a name here? Is there a name that isn't so obvious that you think realistically could end up winning the Royal Rumble? Now, months ago, people thought, well, Edge is going to come back. And Edge is going to win the Rumble. But I think they kind of assumed that Randy Orton would be the champion. And he's not. And that's the probable match for WrestleMania. So what sense would it make for Edge to come back and win the Royal Rumble? I don't want to see that. Again, been there, done that. Doesn't make sense. I mean, not to take anything away from Edge and Drew. I'm sure they'd have a very good match. But again, maybe there's a name I'm not thinking of. But that's how I see things shaping up at this point. Now, let's just switch over to AEW for a second. I did not review Dynamite live this week when it was over because it was delayed due to the NBA. So I reviewed NXT instead. If you want my thoughts on that show, it's on the channel. And I also pushed the audio out to the feed. I am not going to talk about it here. Since there may be more NBA preemptions in the weeks and months ahead, I don't think this was the final one. In fact, it was only the beginning of the season. So as there are more of these preemptions where Dynamite gets delayed by a few hours maybe, one idea that I had thought about, and I even mentioned it on the show, I ended up not doing it, but I had thought about maybe like a watch-along live during the show where I'm watching it along with you guys. And, you know, off camera, I'm just kind of reacting to what's going on and commenting and shooting the shit with you guys, especially during the commercials, taking questions and just, you know, just doing a watch-along, which I've never done on the channel before. I didn't do it. I just figured I'll review NXT instead. I've reviewed NXT a few times on the channel, and this was no different in terms of what I saw as the general lack of interest in NXT. I had half the number of live viewers that I usually get, less than half, even. Now, we still had a lot of people there, and you guys were super chatting, and we were, you know, calling in, and it was a great time, but it was really glaring to see how much lower the number was than it normally would be on a Wednesday night. And I think it's a sad commentary on the state of NXT right now. Now, NXT is not a bad show, but it feels very much like a dead brand at the moment. It really does. You know, people ask me, how come you don't switch off and review AEW live one week and then the next week you do NXT and just do it like every other week, switch off like that? That's why. Because the interest level just isn't there. They could not even beat Dynamite this week in a night where they ran unopposed. So let me know what you think, and maybe we'll do a live watch-along next time. Maybe we'll try it out one time during the next preempted AEW. We'll see how that goes. I am open to the idea. Some good action on Dynamite this week, but nothing you need to go out of your way to see. I'm not going to review the whole show from top to bottom here, but they did open and close the show featuring two of their youngest teams. Their newest, youngest teams trying to get them over, with Chris Jericho and MJF beating Top Flight and the Acclaimed failing to beat the Young Bucks in the main event for the tag team titles. They have used the boombox. Well, they did use the boombox in their previous match with SCU. That's how they earned this match with the Young Bucks. They used the boombox again here. There was no referee, though. Paul Turner, he ran down to the ring to count three, but Matt Jackson kicked out. And the Bucks hit the BTE trigger on Max Caster for the win. They look competitive in there, but I still question the wisdom of vaulting the Acclaimed right into a tag team title match so quickly after winning exactly one match on Dynamite. I don't care how many matches they won on Dark. They won exactly one match on Dynamite, and then boom, they're getting a tag team title match. Yeah, to me, you could have had a match between the Young Bucks and the Acclaimed, where if the Acclaimed win, they beat the champions, then they earn a title match, and they would have lost, but they would have had, you know, an impressive showing. I just didn't think it had to be for the titles. I like that they are trying to get new teams over, though, you know, even as they have a surplus of teams on the roster. I've said that, you know, I believe NXT has the strongest women's division in wrestling right now. Well, AEW's tag team division absolutely buries WWE's tag team division. They bury them miles beneath the earth. Not even close. You've got young teams like Top Flight and the Acclaimed and Private Party and Varsity Blondes, right? They're trying to get them going. You've got Jack Evans and Angelico, the Dark Order, SCU, Best Friends, who are going to be out for a while because Trent has a partial pec tear, a partially torn pec muscle, so he's going to be out of action for a while. But you've got them, you've got the Butcher and the Blade, you've got Santana and Ortiz, the Lucha Bros, Jurassic Express, FTR, the Young Bucks. And that may not even be all of them. I might be missing a few. But if you are a fan of tag team wrestling, AEW is clearly going to be your preferred choice. And it's not just about quantity. It's not just, oh, they have, you know, 25 teams. They have a lot of quality teams on that roster. Some of them are very green, but they have a lot of really quality tag teams on that roster, and it's really their strong suit. Now, I mentioned SCU. They ran an angle on AEW Dark during Britt Baker's waiting room segment with Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian. That was pretty damn good, and really it deserved, I think, to be aired on TV. They were talking about their horrible year, and that every time they lost, Kazarian pointed out, it was you. It was Daniels who took the pin. And he goes, you know, he loves Daniels. He's his best friend. He was his best man at his wedding. But you got to acknowledge what's going on here. And Daniels stopped him and admitted that 2020 was the worst year of his career. He hated coming to work every week. Just thinking of getting on the plane made him sick to his stomach. And he always told himself that he knew when it would be time to walk away, and maybe that time is now. And so he was teasing that this was it. He went to go leave. He was teasing that he was going to retire. And Kazarian stopped him, and he asked him to stay and fight by his side, but only if he agrees to one stipulation. They will become the AEW Tag Team Champions. They've never been AEW Tag Team Champions before. SCU has been champions, but it was Kazarian and Scorpio Sky. Daniels and Kazarian have not been. And he said, you and I are going to become AEW Tag Team Champions. If we don't, we are done forever as a team. The next match they lose, they're finished. And then they saw TH2 in the crowd, Jack Evans and Angelico, and they issued a challenge to them. And what this does is, it makes every match, every SCU match going forward, mean something. It makes every match they have going forward important, because the first one they lose, this team is no more. And if they are, I mean, it's not exactly like they're lacking in tag teams. I don't think the division will skip a beat or miss a beat, but I like the idea of them trying to make every SCU match now feel important, because it didn't. Let's just be honest. It did not feel important before. Now it does. Tony Schiavone interviewed Sting on this show, and again he asked him, why did you come to AEW? We're still trying to get an answer. Why are you here? Why did you come to AEW? We at least got some semblance of an answer, still not a very good one. We also got the best damn Dusty Rhodes impression that I have ever heard, and we got it from Sting, of all people. And everybody, it seems like, has a Dusty Rhodes impression. I think Jim Ross has one, Bruce Pritchard. Everybody who knew him or interacted with him has their own Dusty Rhodes impression. And there are some good ones, but Sting's is on another level. And I don't think I've ever heard him do a Dusty impression before. So it kind of caught me off guard how good it was. I mean, if you closed your eyes, you would swear that it was Dusty Rhodes. But he did the impression and everything because he said it all goes back to Dusty giving him his big break. And when Sting saw Dusty's son, I guess poor Dustin, he's talking about Cody. When he saw Cody, he knew he had to be part of AEW. I guess to help the company, I guess. I don't know. Again, it wasn't the best explanation of why he's here.
But before he could address Darby Allin, who again was up in the stands, watching from the upper deck, out comes Team Taz. And they threatened to come after Sting. The lights went out. When they came back on, Sting was in the ring with the baseball bat. Darby was right next to him with his skateboard. And Taz backed off. You would watch this and think, well, this must be leading to a tag team match of some kind involving Sting. And maybe it will. One thing we learned this week from the man himself, Sting was on the AEW Unrestricted podcast, and we learned that part of the reason he came to AEW was because he told Tony Khan, I'm interested in doing cinematic style matches. And that's because he was unhappy with the way his WWE career ended. He wants to come back and wrestle again, even if it's only cinematically, because he was very unhappy with the way his WWE career came to an end. He said, I did not want to disappear with my tail between my legs. I didn't want it to end the way that it ended. I was pushing to get a cinema-style match with Undertaker. For probably a litany of different reasons, it just wasn't going to happen. So when Tony Khan called and spoke with me, he said, are you interested in doing cinema-style matches? I said, yeah, I am. I thought I'd like to come back and do that and not disappear again with my tail between my legs. I don't have to go out on top, just to go out in a positive light. And for as much as you could say, I guess, that, hey, Sting went out in WWE in the main event of a pay-per-view challenging for the WWE title, right? I mean, I could think of worse ways for him to go out, but I get it. I get it. It was tough to watch the end of that match. He fought through it. He continued the match. They went to the finish. But to see him on wobbly legs like that after that second buckle bomb, and he couldn't even support his own weight, he got whipped into the ropes and he collapsed, it was sad. It was sad to see him in that state. And I can understand him saying, man, I've wrestled all these years, this long career I've had, 25, 30 plus years, and for it to end with me literally collapsing in a heap like that, he feels that he has to go out in a better way. So I get it. Still question the wisdom of him doing any kind of singles match, but if cinematic style matches are what are in his future, then I think that would make the most sense. But let's be perfectly clear on something here. The blame goes both ways for why he never got that match with The Undertaker. Okay, it was there for the taking 5 years ago. If Vince McMahon wanted to do it, if The Undertaker wanted to do it, they could have gotten it done at WrestleMania 31. There really was no reason to not do it at WrestleMania 31, looking back on it now. It would have been a huge attraction. Bigger than Triple H and Sting. So they had their chance, they wasted it. But also, Sting gets some of the blame for that too. Because Sting is the one who kept signing and re-signing those little one-year deals with TNA and Dixie Carter over and over and over again. And he aged in that time another 10 years. 10 years of his career. Might have been more than 10. Spent in TNA. Re-signing year after year when 5 years earlier than he did, he could have said, you know what? I really want to go to WWE. I'm interested in a match with Undertaker. Let me talk to Vince McMahon. Let me talk to his team. See if there's mutual interest. He would have been 5 years younger than he was. And maybe they could have put the match together back then. My sense of it in listening to The Undertaker talk about it a few months ago was he just really didn't think it was going to be a good match. He realized that he's older. He has limitations. Sting is even older than he is. Now, I think Sting looks damn good for his age, especially facially, but he's wearing fucking makeup. So that helps in terms of him not looking really like an old man. He can still go out and cut a promo. He's got this youthful thing about his promos when he's out there. He doesn't sound like an old man. But I really think Undertaker just looked at it and said, man, I don't want to go out there and embarrass myself. If I'm going to go out there, I need to be out there with an AJ Styles or somebody like Shawn, right? AJ's the closest thing, he said, to a Shawn Michaels. Then I know I'll be okay because we can do smoke and mirrors and the guy can bump around for me. He probably looked at it and said, I don't know that we can make this work. I'm 50-something. Sting's, you know, at that time he was in his late 50s. This is going to be a train wreck. I mean, the entrances and the buildup might be great, but when the bell rings, this is going to be a disaster, and I don't want people to remember me or remember this as a disaster. And I think it scared him.
But what if Sting had come in 5-6 years earlier? Would he have had a different opinion on that? You can't blame Vince McMahon for that. The only person to blame for that is Sting. He had a lot of trepidation about coming to WWE. He really worried about how they were going to treat him. Or if they were going to bury him. Oh, he's a WCW guy. I'm going to make him look bad. I don't think they went out of their way to make him look bad, but yeah, guess what? They really did drop the ball with Sting when he came in. Sting wasn't totally wrong. But the blame goes both ways. You can't just put the blame on Vince McMahon and WWE for why that match... And I'm not saying he is. I'm just saying there are a lot of people who will just blame Vince McMahon for that. The blame goes both ways. Both parties deserve blame in that match not taking place. But cinematic style matches is the way to go. Or some kind of multi-man match. But the point is, the big news is, coming out of it, he confirmed it. We will be seeing Sting wrestle in AEW. It just sounds like it may not be in front of a crowd of people. We now have a date for Kip Sabian and Penelope Ford's wedding, February 3rd, on a special Beach Break episode of Dynamite. Tony Schiavone was interviewing the two of them and Miro. And they also threw it to a video up on the screen. They showed us in the back, Trent of Best Friends was being loaded into an ambulance. That's their storyline way of explaining his injuries. They're going to blame it, or I guess credit Miro and Kip for why Trent was injured. Trent got injured in that tag team, that, what was it, 7-on-7 or 6-on-6 match on Dynamite a couple of weeks ago. Apparently that's where the injury took place. So they were talking about the wedding coming up. And now that we have a date, we'll see if Orange Cassidy crashes the wedding. I mean, the wedding is still over a month away. I'm sure it will go about as well as most wrestling weddings do. I'm more interested to see what kind of ratings it draws. Wrestling weddings have typically been good for ratings. So we'll see. There have been some good ones. There have been a lot of really awful ones. But I think the faster we get this wedding nonsense over with and kind of move Miro onto something else, the better off he'll be. Tony Schiavone, boy, he was a busy man on Wednesday. Earlier in the day, he sat down with Sean Spears, who has apparently dumped Tully Blanchard. He took the black glove, he tossed it aside. He was sitting there, you know, wearing a suit, very upset, talking about, you know, when he left New York, he was looking for an opportunity that never came. He said he may have switched companies. The three initials may be different, but the glass ceiling is the same. And I just rolled my eyes. It's like, how original. Here we go again, right, with this nonsense. He said he's better than 95% of the roster, and he's just as good as any of them in the ring, in the gym, or on the mic. Schiavone asked him, you know, have you ever considered the possibility that the problem maybe was you, since the same thing has now happened to you in two different places? Spears said, yeah, I thought about that, and then he got hot at Schiavone and called him an asshole or insulted him. I forgot exactly what he said, but he stormed off. AEW has since removed Sean Spears from their roster page online. Some people were tweeting me, oh, take a look at this. I'm like, it's an angle. Rest assured, it is an angle. I don't know where it's going. But no, they did not fire. They did not release Sean Spears. They're trying something new with him. Is this going to work? Probably not, but we'll see. Sean Spears can talk, no doubt. Sean Spears, he's not a bad wrestler. He can talk. It's just a matter of finding the right role for him. After a quick win over Alexa Garcia, during which she also beat up Abaddon outside the ring, Hikaru Shida grabbed her kendo stick. She went to go back after Abaddon outside. Abaddon came back to life. Two of them started brawling again. And Abaddon then bit Shida on the neck. She feasted on this woman's neck like a vampire. And drew blood. She pulled a Shayna Baszler. Best thing I can say about this is, I like Abaddon. I know some people don't like the character, they don't get it or whatever. I don't know if it's just because I like horror stuff and zombies and shit. I like Abaddon. I like the fact that she's being featured on TV. At least in the case of Abaddon, as opposed to Shayna Baszler, who we never saw do anything like that in our lives. It kind of makes sense. If anybody was going to bite somebody else like a vampire, you got to admit, it would probably be somebody who looked like Abaddon. I'm not saying I liked it. I'm not saying that this is some great angle, but at least in this case, it made sense. And look, if it means that next week, or this week, I guess, coming up, Sheeta shows up in zombie makeup like she's turned as a result of the bite, like something out of The Walking Dead, then I might excuse it. I think I would like that. But we'll see where this goes. And I already talked about the main event, so I'm not going to get into that again. This Wednesday, it is night one of AEW's New Year's Smash. It's going to be a very emotional night, I'm sure, after the events of this weekend. Kenny Omega defends the AEW title against Rey Fénix. The return of Jon Moxley is being advertised. Sheeta defends her women's title against Abaddon. And Jake Hager has issued the challenge to Wardlow, who is not on the show this week. He was tending to family matters. They will meet one-on-one this Wednesday. In 2 weeks, on night two, that's January 6th, Darby Allin defends the TNT title against Brian Cage. Jurassic Express take on FTR. And Cody Rhodes takes on Matt Sydal. And Cody's his fellow judge, his co-host on the Go Big Show, Snoop Dogg, is going to be making an appearance as well. Maybe he'll be doing commentary for Cody's match. So that is the New Year's Smash lineup coming up for the next 2 weeks. We will be back to normal this Wednesday. I'll be reviewing Dynamite Live on YouTube at 10 p.m. And I hope you will join me then. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history takes us back 38 years ago. On Christmas Day 1982, World Class Championship Wrestling presented its first ever Christmas Star Wars event in Dallas, featuring one of the most famous and successful angles of all time, which took place during the main event steel cage match between the visiting NWA World Champion Ric Flair and Kerry Von Erich for the title, with Freebird Michael Hayes, Michael P.S. Hayes, Bad Street USA, as the special enforcer. Hayes was chosen to be the referee because they wanted to have someone who could hold his own in there, since Flair, Flair had a rep. This is all kayfabe, of course, but Flair had a rep for winning many of his matches in controversial fashion. So they wanted to make sure everything was on the up and up. And so when Flair and Kerry both got knocked out during the match, Hayes put Kerry on top of Flair for the three count. But Kerry didn't want to win the match that way. Hayes argued with him and he went to go walk out of the cage. In doing so, Flair shoved Kerry into Hayes and knocked him out of the ring. And when Hayes turned around, all he saw was Kerry. And he didn't know that it was Ric Flair who had caused the shove. Back then, you didn't have all the instant replay and the big Titantron screen where you can replay things the way you can today. So at least he didn't look as dumb as a lot of the baby faces do today when things like that happen, because you can get a million different replays of this stuff. Couldn't really do that on the spot back then. So he thought it was Kerry. And that's when Terry Bam Bam Gordy, another one of the Freebirds, slammed the cage door on Kerry's skull, turning the Freebirds heel for a legendary feud with the Von Erichs, feud that made the promotion and made the wrestlers involved a lot of money. 37 years ago this week, on December 26th, 1983, my father was there for this show. And the reason he was there for that show wasn't just that it was Madison Square Garden. December 26th was his birthday. He would have been 63 years old this week. And so for his birthday, I think it might have been him and my grandfather, they went to the Garden that night. And that was a very important night, because that was the night that Bob Backlund's 2,135-day reign as WWE Champion came to an end. If you, of course, ignore the Phantom title change with Antonio Inoki, then you get to 2,135 days. That is the second longest reign in company history, behind only Bruno Sammartino's first run. He beat him out at 2,803 days. An infamous night of wrestling this was in Madison Square Garden. The evil Iranian, the Iron Sheik, had the All-American. Bob Backlund in the camel clutch. Backlund was refusing to submit when his manager, Arnold Skoland, threw in the towel. And the Sheik was awarded the title, but his reign would not last very long. The very next day, on December 27th, at one of three WWE shows that night, just to show you how many towns they would run in a single night, they had an A team, a B team, and a C team. And I think on some days they had a D team. They could be running three or four different towns all over the country, or all up and down the East Coast. The schedule that they had these guys on back then was ridiculous. But on that night, one of the three shows was in St. Louis. And on that show, Hulk Hogan would make his return to the company after a three-year absence, fresh off his run in the AWA. And the following month, he would take the championship from the Iron Sheik back at MSG. Sheik was the bridge. He was the transitional champion to get the title off of the old babyface and onto the new one. And the reason being, Bob Backlund was asked to turn heel and drop the belt to Hulk Hogan, and he refused. And it wasn't a case of him refusing because he didn't like Hogan or he just didn't want to do the job or anything like that, but or at least that's not what he claims. He talks about this in his book. He said his daughter at the time was 6 years old, and she was about to start school. And at that time, he was also going around the country, and he was hosting different Bob Backlund, children's wrestling tournaments. He was teaching them how to do things the right way and how to stay out of trouble and all that. And he didn't want to turn his back on those kids. And he also didn't want to run the risk of his daughter being bullied and picked on at school because her daddy is on TV being a bad guy. So he refused. He refused to turn heel. And so Vince McMahon was very surprised. Vince McMahon was shocked 10 years later when Backlund was sitting in his office at Titan Tower. And at that point, he was midway through his comeback. He had this big comeback in 1992 into 93. He was 43 years old at the time. They were going for the underdog story. Bob Backlund, you know, he's coming back. He's going to try to recapture past glory. So by that point, when he's in that meeting with Vince, he's already about midway through his comeback. And it's not going so well. And Vince McMahon was shocked when Bob Backlund was the one who floated the idea of turning heel. This is when he realized that his big babyface comeback was kind of sputtering. It's not going the way he had hoped. And do you know who he credits for his preachy heel character on TV? He actually credits someone for that. And I never knew this. Rush Limbaugh. So as he tells the story, Backlund is in his car. He's got the radio on one night, and he comes across Rush Limbaugh's radio show, and he had a caller on the line who was complaining about how awful her life was. I don't know, she was complaining about whatever, I don't know if she's complaining about her marriage or her kids or I don't know, but she's complaining about something. Woe is me. And Rush just had enough. And he went off on this woman about all the bad choices that she made in her life, and she didn't want to take responsibility for, and Bob had his eureka moment that there were too many people who, in life, who wanted to take the easy road, who weren't willing to work hard for what they wanted. The world had changed so much, and he felt that he could become the bad guy by playing the good guy, the guy who blamed the fans and blamed society for everything that was wrong with society and everything that was wrong in their lives. You know, the whole, like, I didn't change, you people changed. That whole thing. And it worked. But the only reason he didn't turn heel sooner is because his family was more important to him. And you got to respect the guy who puts his family first. 33 years ago this week, on the December 26, 1987 episode of WWF Superstars, which was taped many weeks earlier, Bobby Heenan and the Islanders kidnapped the British Bulldogs mascot, Matilda. Their match went to a no contest when they grabbed the dog and ran out of the arena with her. The Bulldogs, it always makes me chuckle when you see the Bulldogs chasing after them. And as they come through the doorway to go into the hallway in the back, I think Davy Boy slips first. I don't know if it was because there was something wet on the floor or what, but he kind of slips. He trips and falls. And Dynamite couldn't stop himself. And because Davy fell, then Dynamite ends up falling. So that kind of looked ridiculous. And then they're chasing after the Islanders trying to get their dog back. This entire angle was ridiculous. But it did lead to Bobby Heenan wearing a dog suit for a match. Six-man match at WrestleMania. The very next day, one of the most memorable debuts in wrestling history took place at a New Japan event at Sumo Hall. And what followed was a fan riot that led to New Japan being banned from holding events at that venue for 2 years. They weren't allowed to come back for 2 years after what happened on this night. Now, in recent weeks, in this segment, you have heard me talk about Antonio Inoki forming New Japan Pro Wrestling. He was looking to bring in, at the time, a new monster heel. Wanted to bring in a new monster heel character, and he had become familiar with a famous manga artist by the name of Go Nagai, who would go on to create the Jushin Liger character a couple of years later that spawned, you know, obviously one of the most famous wrestlers in Japanese wrestling history. Vader was a character out of Japanese folklore. And Nagai did the concept art for it with the samurai headgear. And I mean, it kind of looks like an elephant, but it's a samurai style headgear. And there are sketches. I don't know where they are exactly, but apparently there are sketches out there of the character looking ripped. So in its original incarnation, they were imagining somebody who almost just looked like this ripped superhero-like person, which is why Jim Helwig was either the first or the second choice for the role, depending on, I mean, I've read it both ways. I've read differing accounts on this. I believe Helwig was the first choice. Gary Hart, in his book, and shout out to Brian for sending me a copy of his book after he heard me mention, it was a mailbag question last week. Somebody mentioned the Gary Hart book, and it's out of print. It's been out of print for many years. And lo and behold, I received a copy of the book. So Gary Hart was working at the time with Helwig in Texas. This is when he was Dingo Warrior down there in World Class. When he got the call from Pat Patterson to go work for the WWE, WWE wanted to bring Warrior in. Warrior was headed to Japan, though, were it not for that phone call. So, you know, they made the better offer. He chose to go work for them as the Ultimate Warrior instead of going to Japan. And the rest is history. I mean, you talk about a decision that affected two different careers in such a dramatic way. That could have gone very differently. Sid Vicious was the other choice for the role, but ultimately, Inoki chose Leon White. And on this night, Vader was scheduled to tag with Masa Saito against Tatsumi Fujinami and Kengo Kimura. And before the match, somebody grabbed the microphone and challenged Inoki to a match. I guess on behalf of the team. I don't recall exactly who it was who issued the challenge. It might have been the manager. He grabbed the mic and they issued a challenge to Inoki. Well, Inoki was the main attraction, and he rarely lost. I mean, he rarely lost matches back then. It had probably been at least a couple of years before he had lost the match at that point. That night, he was scheduled to have a match against another big name in Riki Choshu. So all of a sudden, somebody else wants to challenge Inoki. And the fans, this is where the trouble began. Because the fans picked up on this and they thought that they were about to be screwed out of their main event. That was the reason they bought the tickets to go to the show that night. They were expecting to see Inoki against Choshu. And at least some of the fans in the building thought, wait a minute, what is going on here? Are we not going to get that main event?
and the fans were not very happy. They started throwing things into the ring, like eggs and beer cans. I'd like to think the fans always brought eggs with them to the buildings back then, just in case, you know, the promoter tried to screw them out of their main event. Always have an egg or two in your back pocket. Just don't sit down on it. So eventually the match did happen. People got their main event. The problem is it lasted all of 6 minutes. And it ended when another wrestler ran in to save Choshu, who was locked in a submission. He refused to give up. So it ended on a disqualification. And the fans were not happy. All of a sudden, down to the ring comes Vader in his giant headgear, making his big debut. The gauntlet is thrown down to Inoki, and they have an impromptu match, which doesn't even last a full 3 minutes, and Vader beats him. He beats him with a power slam right there, 1, 2, 3, in the middle of the ring, clean as a sheet. Then he kept beating on Inoki when the match was over. He wouldn't let up, kept beating on him and beating on him. The fans are still very angry. Now, I'm sure you have a contingent of fans in the crowd who are shocked. They love Inoki. They're shocked that he lost, and they're upset about that and what this new guy is doing to him. But one thing I didn't realize many years ago when I had first heard the tale of Vader's debut is that the fans were probably angry about something else, even more than they were angry. It wasn't just that Inoki lost. I mean, it makes for a good story, but the fans were already in a very rowdy state, and they were more upset about their crappy main event, I guess, than they were about anything else. They felt cheated. They felt shortchanged. And the fans were, it was so out of control, it took the police an hour to get things under control. And New Japan was not allowed back inside Sumo Hall based on all the damage until 1989. 27 years ago this week, on December 27th, 1993, speaking of Vader, he defended the WCW World title in the main event against Ric Flair. One of my top 15 WCW matches of all time. 15 greatest matches in WCW history, that countdown I did 4 years ago. It wasn't a ranked list, but that match was on the list. If I did rank it, it probably would be in the top five. I'd have to go back and see. It's a great match. This was in Flair's hometown of Charlotte. And you would think that this spot was tailor-made for a Ric Flair win, but that was not the original plan. Flair's spot was originally intended for Sid Vicious. Boy, there's a lot of plans with Sid Vicious that end up falling through if you look back over the years. But that was going to be Sid's spot. Sid was likely going to win the title that night. But then he and Arn Anderson almost killed each other over a pair of scissors overseas in the UK. And Sid got fired. And instead, we ended up with an all-time classic. Contrast that to what would come 1 year later at Starrcade on the same night, that very same date, 1 year later. We went from one of the greatest matches in Starrcade history to one of the worst, with Hulk Hogan defending the WCW World title against The Butcher. Not The Butcher from AEW. This was a very different Butcher. One of many, many, many names that Ed Leslie went by in his career. Also on that show, in, I guess it would have been 95. No, 94. End of 94. Alex Wright pinned Jean-Paul Levesque, which was Triple H's one and only pay-per-view match in WCW before leaving for the World Wrestling Federation. 23 years ago this week, on December 22nd, 1997, WCW presented NWO Monday Nitro, which ran opposite a taped episode of Raw is War. I think it was taped about 10 or 11 days prior, which included Shawn Michaels dropping his European Championship to fellow DX member Triple H in a very hard-fought battle. Those guys had a hard-fought match that night. And a segment that they showed, now this did not take place in the same building, but what they did that night was they aired a segment, basically a dark segment, that was taped at the arena the previous week that showed Stone Cold Steve Austin giving Santa Claus a Stone Cold Stunner. Santa was played by an independent wrestler from the Northeast. His first name was Roy. This, according to Bruce Pritchard. And the little boy who was invited into the ring, who sat in Santa's lap and told him, "You're not the real Santa Claus," before Santa kicked him out of the ring and sent him back to his seat in the front row. That little boy, if you go back and you watch it, is one of the Usos. Now take your pick which one it is. I mean, I could tell them apart now. Some people say they can't. To me, it's pretty easy to tell them apart now. I think it was Jay. Just looking at the kid, I think it was Jay Uso. But it was one of Rikishi's kids. Fatu, he wasn't doing the Rikishi gimmick at that time, but Fatu was backstage. He had his kids with him that night, and they decided to use one of the twins in this angle. So technically, when you look back at the Usos, one of them, you know, where did they make their debut? One of them made their debut in Santa's lap, right here on TV on this episode of Raw. But Stone Cold came out. He was not happy about the way he had treated this little boy, and Stone Cold came out, and he gave Santa a stunner. Steve Austin is the only man in the world who can say that they have assaulted Santa Claus and the President of the United States. If that isn't enough to give the man GOAT status, then I don't know what is. But over on TNT, Nitro was a three-hour show. It was the go-home show to their biggest Starrcade ever. Not before, nor after, did they ever do as big of a buy rate as they did for that pay-per-view at the end of 1997. Near the end of Hour 1, the NWO started transforming the show into their own, and this took forever, because they literally were transforming the show live on the air. It wasn't like, hey, welcome to NWO Nitro. In the middle of the show, they just took it over, so they're changing the signage over, and it was boring, is what it was. It wasn't very exciting. The next 2 hours, what it was an experiment to see how the show would do. WCW was getting ready to add a brand new show very soon called Thunder, which Eric Bischoff says he resisted as much as possible. He knew it was a terrible idea, but Turner insisted on it. WCW was doing so well. Well, let's have another show. And Eric Bischoff realized why that was a bad idea, didn't want to do it. Ultimately, though, he had to do what his bosses told him to do. And so he claims that one of the main reasons why they expanded the NWO roster to these comically large proportions, they were adding people left and right, was because the idea is that NWO would get Nitro and WCW would have Thunder as their show, which is not unlike what, you know, Jim Ross has talked about the plan was in WWE for the Invasion, where they were going to give Raw to WCW and WWE, like SmackDown was going to become the WWE show. And of course, it ended up not happening, but here in WCW, that was the idea. They wanted to test the waters and see, okay, maybe if Nitro becomes the NWO show and then Thunder becomes the WCW show, well, you know, if we're going to do that, we need a roster for Nitro. There's got to be a whole bunch of NWO members, because otherwise we're not going to have a roster. So in effect, it was sort of the brand split, their version of one, before WWE ever did one. So it was an experiment. It failed. It failed miserably. The TV ratings dropped 25% in the middle of this show. And Raw that night actually beat Nitro in the 10 p.m. hour, which is just something that did not happen back then. It was a small victory, but it was a victory for WWE. And then Nitro that night ended with Hulk Hogan accepting a present, a gift box from a mystery sender. He thought it was Eric Bischoff. Oh, Eric, you shouldn't have. Eric's trying to tell him, Hulk, it's not for me. And Hulk's like, you shouldn't have done. And he opens the box. And what's in the box? Remember Brad Pitt? What's in the box? So I'll tell you what's in the box. What was in the box is the same thing that was in the box in the movie. It was Hogan's own severed head. They had a mannequin head for Hollywood Hogan, and this scared him so much. He just stood there. He was in a panic. He couldn't believe it. The final shot of Nitro that night was Sting. All of a sudden, here's Sting. Sting is standing on top of the entranceway. He's not all the way up in the rafters. He's right on top of the entranceway. And he is taking forever because they're going to do a zip line where he zip lines into the ring, and it is taking forever. Hogan is standing there staring at him, and he's Sting is trying to get hooked up and whatever, and he's waiting and waiting and waiting. He took the final shot. It took so long that by the time he was zipping so slowly that by the time he actually was almost to the ring, he didn't even get to the ring in time. He's about to zip line into the ring, and they had to cut him off, and the show went off the air because he took so long. That is how the final Nitro ended before the big Hogan Sting match at Starrcade. 22 years ago this week, on December 27th, 1998, another nail in the coffin for WCW, and really the beginning of the end for them, as Kevin Nash becomes the first man to pin Bill Goldberg and end his undefeated streak, winning the WCW World Heavyweight Championship in the main event when Scott Hall cattle prods Goldberg behind the referee's back, and Nash powerbombs him for the win. 1 week later came the now infamous finger poke of doom on Nitro when Kevin Nash laid down for Hollywood Hogan to get the belt back onto Hogan. When the show was over that night, leaving the arena, the announcers for that night were Tony Schiavone, Mike Tenay, and Bobby Heenan. So as they're leaving the building, I think they were in D.C. They're leaving the building that night. Mike Tenay, who came up with the entire concept of the undefeated streak, that was his idea. Goldberg has credited him with the idea before. He and Bobby Heenan both told Tony Schiavone that the collapse of the company, it was only a matter of time. Like, this was the beginning of the end. And Schiavone thought they were overreacting. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, didn't happen right away. But just over 2 years later, WCW no longer existed as a company on its own. Although, again, there were a lot of reasons for why that happened. Ending Goldberg's streak would not even be in the top three list of things that killed WCW, but you can add that to the list. 14 years ago this week, on December 23rd, 2006, Ring of Honor hosted its final battle show from the Manhattan Center. This was only my third live Ring of Honor show. Jay and Mark Briscoe beat the Kings of Wrestling in what was supposed to be Claudio Castagnoli's final match before heading to WWE. And when the match was over, he cut a promo and he said that he might actually be sticking around for a little bit longer. So he must have known that things hit a snag with WWE. I believe it may have been a visa issue at that time. Whatever it was, he ended up not going to WWE for another 5 years. It's not like something that, all right, well, I have to wait a few months or, you know, next year. He didn't go to WWE for another 5 years, did Cesaro. And 14 years later, I would argue he still has not realized his full potential. Shameful. This was also the Ring of Honor debut of Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney as Chris Hero's new agent. One of the great wrestling tragedies was Larry Sweeney. That man would have been a superstar. Not a doubt in my mind. I'm sure anybody who knew him would say the same thing. The closest thing to a new generation version of Bobby Heenan or Jim Cornette was Larry Sweeney. And in the main event, Homicide beat Brian Danielson, call him whatever you want. He'll always be Brian Danielson to me, to become Ring of Honor World Champion for the very first time, ending Brian's 15-month reign as champion. And 2 years ago this week, this is a fun one to end on here. On December 21st, 2018, you've heard me talk about the greatest tweet ever twittered from Hulk Hogan, right back in 2011. Good night, Hulkamaniacs and jabroni marks without a life that don't know it'll work when you work a work and work yourself into a shoot, marks. That will never be topped. It should be framed and hung in the Smithsonian. But this may be my second favorite. Stephanie McMahon, tweeted a Flashback Friday photo of her and her brother celebrating Christmas when they were little kids. Well, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, was obviously going through his Twitter timeline, and he saw the photo. He saw the tweet that Stephanie shared, and he thought it was just the cutest thing. He thought it was adorable. And he decided to post a comment in response to this lovely photo. It said, "Merry Christmas. Two handsome young men there." Oops. Yes, the Million Dollar Man referred to the Billion Dollar Princess as a handsome young man. Now, he later deleted the tweet, but as we all know, and now he does, the internet never forgets. And that is this week in wrestling history. This has been a rough weekend. Getting that news, I had to blow things up a bit at the beginning. I had everything all prepared for today's show, and then I heard that news last night, and it just threw me for a loop, as I think it has pretty much everybody. And so what I had to do, I bumped my Wrestle Kingdom preview to next Sunday. I'm not doing it this week. We'll talk about that next week. I hope I at least did the Brody Lee stuff, you know, the John Huber stuff, some justice. I just made a short list of a couple of some of the things I wanted to touch on. And otherwise, just figured I would sit here and pour out whatever comes out, because what do you say about a situation like this? It still doesn't feel real. Even sitting here talking about it, it's not right. It's just such a depressing thing. And I'm just a fan. I never had the chance to meet him. I never had the chance to get to know him or interview him. So my heart goes out to his family. My heart goes out to his friends. He will be missed. He will be missed beyond a shadow of a doubt. Just look at the outpouring of love and the messages and the stories. He definitely made his mark. And he will be missed. I hope you will all join me for back-to-back live streams, both of them this week at 10 p.m. Eastern. The first one on Wednesday night, as soon as AEW Dynamite goes off the air. This is going to be the final Dynamite stream of the year. And I hope you will, and like I said earlier, probably a very emotional night. I hope you will join me for that. And the very next night on Thursday, come celebrate with me my To Hell with 2020 New Year's Eve stream, 10 p.m. Eastern. We're going to answer your questions. I'm going to be taking email questions, sound off inbox style, and we'll take super chats and maybe some calls. We'll get interactive with it as we count down, wait for the ball to drop. And we try to count down the end of this horrible year and the beginning of 2021. Again, the email is thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. And help me ring in 2021 and end this year already. Just end this year. I think we have all had enough. I want to thank you for tuning in this week. I want to thank you for all of your support this year. And until then, until next time, be well, stay safe. Tomorrow isn't promised, so make the most of today. Happy New Year.